tomorrow again. But of course the schedules are becoming more and more full as we move on. And we've got some apologies, of course, and they are from the Honourable Jitlangoma Mabasa, who is the Economic Development Committee as we talk. And then we have the late arrival of Honourable Khadebe, you'll be here in a few minutes, as well as Kwabasa, and Honourable Waili will be here at 10. Well, it is 10, isn't it? Yes. So on that basis, I'm not aware of any other apologies, except for the standard ones. Honourable Hill Lewis, I was hoping would be here for our last committee meeting tomorrow, so I will write to the party on that matter, because it's the legacy document we want to pass tomorrow. The Honourable Maria, who was replacing them, I understand that in a way that's fallen by the way a little. And then Dr. the Honourable Oriani Ambrosini is of course still on medical leave. So those are our apologies. So we'd certainly like to welcome initially the DTI, who is with us here. We've got the Director General, Mr. Lionel October, thank you very much. And we've also got the DDGs here with us. That is Ms. Zodwa Ntuli, and also we have a DDG who was, I saw him around, he's pretty new on as a confirmed DDG, Mr. Garth Strachan, congratulations. And then, of course, we have the Chief Operating Officer with us, Ms. Jodie Spoltz, and also is Ms. Sara Chuane here. Because I didn't see her, but her name is here. And then we have Mr. Stephen Harnable, Chief Economist, Mr. Shabir Khan, the Chief Financial Officer, and Ms. Pumla Inkapai. Ms. Pumla, because I don't see her either. But right before us, as we start, we're going to be starting off with the National Consumer Commission. And thank you very much, Minister. I did indicate you could come at 5:30, but I know you like to keep your hand in, yeah. So, thank you very much. But we've got Mr. Ibrahim Mohammed, Commissioner of the NCC. We also have a Deputy Commissioner with us, and that is, let's see, is that Mr., how do you pronounce it, Tezi Mabusa? Teddy Mabusa, right. So thank you very much, everyone. If I've overlooked your name, please let me know. Is it Mr. Naren Babs Kujis? Thank you. Thank you very much, members. On my right. Just a minute. Adoption of the agenda. Can we please have someone to propose the adoption? Thank you, Honourable Salah, seconded by Honourable, I was about to say Swahili, Swanapu. Right, immediately over to yourselves then, Commissioner. Basically, our concern would be, as we come to the end of 5 years, we looked briefly then at the third quarterly, at some of the alerts that have popped up. But bear in mind, we're also at the end of 5 years. And during that time, the NCC has, of course, had an interesting history. And what we would like you to share with us of some of the challenges you face and are facing, ways you've tried to overcome them, and the achievements, what you have been able to make progress with. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Firstly, I would like to apologize for the date on the presentation. We had initially been informed that this presentation would be, this meeting would be tomorrow, and hence the date. Apologies for not having changed that. Thank you. Just an outline of the presentation. We will give an overview of the third quarterly report, and then achievements against planned targets. We will then ask, with your leave, Chair, for Mr. Babskulji to present the financial management aspect, and then we'll go on to talk about progress against the AG's findings, and then deal with some of the key challenges. On the overview of the third quarterly report, before I do that, I would like to introduce to this committee Ms. Tezi Mabuza, our Deputy Commissioner, who was appointed by Minister and who commenced her duties in February this year. Ms. Mabuza has already been making a difference at the NCC, and she's adding tremendous value, especially in the area of operations. Chair, the NCC is extremely grateful for the additional funds that it has been allocated as from 2014-2015 onwards. 10 million rand, in addition to the initial MTEF allocation, has been laid to the NCC. Well, this will go a long way in the NCC executing its mandate, in realizing its objectives, and recruiting more suitably qualified staff and personnel. The NCC intends utilizing 10 million rand by dividing half. Half will be utilized for the recruitment of personnel, and the other half will go towards projects. Chair, this committee is aware of the problems that the NCC had with certain staff members in the past. Disciplinary proceedings have commenced against the Chief Financial Officer and one other senior employee. The process has been slow, but we are now at the stage where dates for the hearings have been set. The disciplinary hearings will take place towards the end of this month, on the 28th and 29th of March. There has been much progress in the management of the risks, and the vast majority of findings by the Auditor General. The appointment of the risk manager and the internal auditors has added much impetus to risk identification and mitigation, and later on in the presentation I shall talk a bit more about progress with regards to the AG's findings. Chair, applications for condemnation of certain irregular transactions that took place in previous financial years are underway. The main reason for the NCC having had a qualified audit finding last year is being addressed. To remind this committee, the NCC could not prove irregular expenditure last year due to the theft of important documentary evidence. The condemnation application are underway to the Treasury. Meetings have been held with the DTI, with the Treasury, with the Auditor General staff, and the Accountant General will also be involved when it comes to this application. The financial records of the NCC have improved dramatically and are now reliable. The unavailability of NCC financial records are a thing of the past. The Group CFO of the DTI recently commented that it has improved by more than 10 times. The cost containment measures introduced by Treasury has been implemented in its entirety. The contact centre, which is an area of much concern in the past, including the email and telephone systems, is now functioning without any disruption, albeit minor sporadic hiccups. Complaints about complaints still come in, but those are beginning to lessen. Chair, this is a problem that the NCC has experienced since inception. We took on far too many complaints. We have now re-looked at our mandate. We've identified certain areas of work that can be referred to other agencies, and that is now happening. I shall later on address the question of the backlog. When I took over the NCC, it was riddled with problems, governance, administration, financial issues, and I concentrated on getting all of that right. Unfortunately, the operations area did not receive the attention that it should have received. With the appointment now of our Deputy Commissioner, who has taken charge of all operations, this area will certainly be given top priority. I do know that there have been several complaints all over about the tardy responses of the NCC. Questions relating to process flow, turnaround times, response times are all and will all be addressed, and are currently being addressed. Thank you. The complaints backlog, as I said, is no longer a challenge. We had, I think, 6,045 complaints, a backlog of complaints. That has been reduced at the end of the quarter to about 73% had been dealt with, but as of date, 77% have been dealt with. We are now left with about 759 complaints in the backlog, and we should have, we must have it completely obliterated by the end of the current month, by the end of the financial year. With regards to fruitless and wasteful expenditure, attorneys have been engaged in order to recover this fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Financial service providers have been engaged for a period of 6 months to assist with processes, asset management, and supply chain. And then the internal audit and audit committee has been functional. Audit committee has been meeting regularly and will meet again on Tuesday, the 18th of March. May I then proceed to the achievements against plan target. In terms of the annual performance plan, there were 12 targets to be achieved. Just for information, the meat investigation report, the meat investigation that was conducted by the NCC, its report was used to inform labeling requirements published by the department. Out of the 12 targets to be achieved, two were not met. As opposed to having resolved 60% of complaints within 80 days, we managed to achieve 44% of the complaints within the 40 days. This was largely due to the lack of drafting skills within the enforcement division, and the legal division is now assisting with drafting of non-referral letters. The other target that was not met was that the NCC was supposed to complete 6 investigations in the period. 3 investigations were finalized and approved. But I hasten to add that 13 other investigations who were also finalized, but they had not yet been approved as of the end of December. Chair, we then have the grid of the achievements as against targets. I know not whether this committee wishes me to go through each of them. I have just dealt with the targets that were not achieved. I rely on guidance by this committee as to whether I should go through all of these. I indicated that I'm relying on the committee to guide as to whether I should go through all the milestones and achievements.
I think that would be valuable for us, please. Because I'm just looking back, you know, achievements against planned targets.
Yes. Now, with regard to page 8, then, of the presentation, in the quarterly milestone with regard to the registration and the analysis of complaints, the NCC was supposed to register complaints within 3 days and to analyze complaints within an average of 8 days. We were supposed to have that 95% of that done within the quarter. The NCC actually registered and analyzed all the complaints received during that period. Much of the reason for this is that there was a lull in the receipt of complaints during the December period, and not as many complaints received during that period. With regards to the complaints that were finalized and resolved within 80 days, I've already addressed that. I said we achieved only 44% of the 60%, and the main reason for that was that non-referrals could not be drafted due to the lack of legal skills, and the legal department has now come in to assist with that. Both the Deputy Commissioner and I have been signing off letters of non-referral, large stacks of letters of non-referral over the past few weeks. I've already also dealt with the investigations that were finalized and approved. We talked about the backlog. It's already been addressed. The recommendation of codes to the minister, no codes were received during the past 6 months. So, and the receipt of codes are dependent on industries or sectors applying for legislation. Then a number of consumer awareness initiatives were conducted. Two induction workshops with GTI field workers, workshops with people living with disabilities, happened in the Ennerdale and the Lady communities, mall and train exhibitions, two exhibitions were held, one in the city of Tshwane in fashion, and the office of the Premier in Bronkhorst Street. With regard to, then there was a workshop held at the Sunnyside Primary School, and the school club quiz themselves at the Sunnyside Primary School. Number of codes of good practice developed. In terms of Section 93 of the code, in draft Section 93 of the code, code of good practice for the return of vehicles within the motor industry is still under development. The code should be completed by the end current quarter. With regards to the recruitment of staff and the position, percentage of positions filled, the milestone was that we should fill 39% we had managed to fill 40% of the staff establishment. The NCC was supposed to develop a high-level ICT strategy internally, and this will be completed by the end of the quarter four. Preparatory work such as workshops held with the GTI and so on has happened, and that target has been met. We actually had meetings with one stakeholder, we met with two, with NEDLAC and the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications. An internal newsletter was developed and distributed. The NCC addressed two conferences, so the World Retail Conference and the Complaints Management Conference. This was not part of the quarter three target, but the conferences were used to promote the NCC. There were several media responses. I'm not going to go through each of them. And there was one meeting with the Provincial Consumer Protection Authorities at the Consumer Protection Forum. The risk register. The strategy has been circulated to Audit Committee members for comments and will be discussed at the Audit Committee meeting on the 18th of March. Thank you, Chair. May I ask that my colleague, Mr. Kulji, then takes us through the financial aspect of the report, if I may.
You can do that briefly. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'll try and be extremely brief given the circumstances. Honourable Chair, Commissioner has already spoken about the condemnation in relation to irregular transactions. I think it should be brought to the attention of this committee that the NCC did incur fruitless and wasteful expenditure in the sum of 26,400 rand. This, however, was incurred in the previous financial year, closed this year, primarily arose from SARS having levied penalty and interest relative to employees' tax not being paid on time. Then there was a non-recurring irregular expenditure, which has started, I think, in the current financial year, in the sum of 800,000 rand. 690,000 rand, Honourable Chair, relates to the call centre. Prior to that being incurred, consultations were held with the Auditor General of South Africa. And despite having incurred irregular expenditure, the Commission did save, I think, approximately 700,000 rand in the entire transaction. Then there was some insurance that the Commission had to purchase, and that was primarily at a time when there were break-ins at the NCC, computers were being stolen, and regrettably there was just one quote that was received in relation to that. Then the recurring irregular expenditure, Honourable Chair, this started, I think, since the inception of the NCC. Primarily relates to the lease of the premises and the telecommunications aspect. That is currently being dealt with, as was explained by Commissioner with the AG. The income statement, Honourable Chair, I'm not going to dwell on that, except I'm going to skip to the notes to the statement of financial performance. In this instance, I should just alert the committee that the NCC received approximately 45 million rand from the National Treasury via the Department of Trade and Industry. In addition, the DTI did assist the NCC by providing an additional 961,000 rand to assist with its IT infrastructure. Over and above that, the DTI transferred some computer equipment for which we are ever so grateful for. The employee costs and operating expenditure by the end of third quarter, Honourable Chair, amounted to approximately 31,500,000 rand. And then the next item is the balance sheet. I'm going to skip once again to the notes in relation to the statement of financial position. Honourable Chair, you'll note that the balance as at the end of or the bank balance was in the sum of 18 million rand. That is primarily made up of interest, the balance of the grant income, and some of the monies that should have been deemed surplus, for which the NCC has applied for retention. There's the aspect of trade and other receivables. Here we're talking about amounts owing to the National Consumer Commission in the sum of 276,000 rand. Those matters have been handed in for collection. Then there's a sum of 43,208 rand that's actually owing by employees. Largely relates to medical aid funds that have that are being dealt with on a monthly basis. Then there's the creditors aspect, trade and other payables, which is 930,831 rand. Honourable Chair, the actual expenditure and for the month of December, if I can just draw your attention to the second last column on the right. That was the actual expenditure for until December 2013. The last column is extremely important in that it indicates the variances. You would note, Honourable Chair, that there's a number of underspending on certain items, overspending. That, however, was fixed up in the last quarter. There's been a shifting of funds and the budget was remedied. Honourable Chair?
You mean you don't mean the one before, but you mean the fourth quarter?
Yes. It was remedied in the fourth quarter. But what we present to you, Honourable Chair, is as it stood in at the end of December, and then there's an explanation relating to the variances, explaining all of that in the last two slides. Thank you.
Chair, I will then deal with the progress on the AGSA's findings. Chair, there's been full, open, transparent cooperation with the Auditor General of South Africa. Regular meetings and discussions and advice sought are held with the AG staff. All the previous findings of the Auditor General have been tracked and genuine progress has been made against all the findings. These findings relate to the absence of policies, the revision of internal processes in supply chain management, finance, asset management, the recruitment of personnel, leave management, travel, etc. Action plans have been drafted and the vast majority have been implemented. On the next slide, we will note that the external audit conducted for the financial year 12-13 by the AGRA is 96 findings and recommendations. This necessitated 96 action plans. Of the 96 action plans, 79 have been implemented and 17 are in progress. From the analysis performed on the outstanding matters, which constitute 18% of the total action plans, it is evident that there have been some delays in implementation. However, there has been a genuine improvement in implementation of the outstanding matters in quarter four. a few matters will require more time than was initially envisaged. For example, in the Neotel contract, where new negotiations are currently on course. The recovery of funds, the matters are with lawyers and process legal processes take time. And then the aligning of the budget and performance, which can only be resolved fully and correctly in the next financial year. Chair, I've then just included the AG's dashboard for on our internal controls for March 2013 and for December 2013. One would notice that there were many more red places on the March 2013 report. If one looks at the December 2013 report, one can see that that has changed dramatically and that there are only two red places now, which we are dealing with. Chair, with regards to the challenges, I think we've already spoken to some of them. I spoke about the obliteration of the backlog at the end of the current financial year, end of the current month. But I also mentioned the problem with regard to the tardy responses by the NCC. I mentioned that for the appointment of the Deputy Commissioner, who's now taken full charge of operations, that this matter is being addressed. Meetings are held regularly. I think she's meeting with the staff again on Thursday to look at process flow, turnaround times, response times, and so on. It is one area that I would like to see resolved within the shortest possible period. With regards to the staff establishment, 182 positions were approved by Minister. 71 of these positions are full, and 111 positions are vacant in the overall establishment. 28 positions have been advertised, and several positions which have become redundant positions could be abandoned shortly. For the lack of skills at the NCC, internal training has been made compulsory on a weekly basis, and with the increased budget for 2014-2015, we should also have sufficient resources or more resources to assist in that regard. Chair, there's and with regards to one challenge that wasn't that does not appear on here is the question relating to getting the word out there for consumers, communicating with consumers nationally. Now, even though budget has been a problem, there have been attempts to get the word out there. But we are also now utilizing other fora. We are partnering with other organizations, with the National Consumer Tribunal. There is also a communications forum that was started by the COTI institutions that we are utilizing in order to assist the NCC in getting the word out there to consumers because of our lack of funding. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. We're going to move immediately over to the committee members. Any comment, questions? Here's your opportunity. Just brief. Right, Honourable Swanepoel, Honourable James, Honourable Shopee-Satorne.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just very briefly, what we don't get from the presentation is a sense of the complaints that you're receiving. If we can just get a sense of that complaint, that will also help us understand the complexity of the work that needs to be done. on the one hand. On the other hand, how many are being resolved in favor of the consumer and how many are being resolved in favor of the supplier? If we can just get a sense of the outcomes of the work done. I realize you don't have all the stats, you have just the sense. That's the first part. And the second question relates to the staffing of the organization. Clearly that's a problem if more than half the posts aren't filled. But added to that, what I'd like to know is, are those posts funded? So as the posts get filled up, is there money in place to match those appointments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. A similar question, because your purpose is to serve the consumer and to protect the consumer against shoddy work and shoddy equipment and shoddy service and so on and so forth. And so one wants to have a sense of how well you're doing given the money, that taxpayers' money that you're spending. I mean, what is a citizen getting for the amount of money spent against the NCC? And I suppose that's Honourable Swanepoel's same question. So I'm ready to amplify that.
Thank you, Honourable James. Honourable Shopee is talking.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's good for you to have a less red faces from the Auditor General. But I just want to refer to page 5 of your report, that you have got, you do have an audit committee. And I would like, if it is possible, to also have a report of your audit committee. And I just want to know as to, I see it's functional, but how independent is that audit committee? Because it does help for you to have an audit committee that reports, and you taking it very seriously, it will also improve your relationship with the Auditor General.
Thank you. Honorable Adede.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that when we requested the NCC to come here, it's because UDT was still considered as a crawling baby. It was considered as a crawling baby because of the teething problems it had. But the Chairperson, I think that when coming to the issue of the dashboard, it's actually worrying, né, that of the dashboard, Auditor General dashboard, what is the issue? The references are at the wrong place here. When you deal with the compliance to laws and regulations, and then there's a red face there, it could cause to question almost everything which is happening at that institution. I don't know what remedies they are having in place to ensure that that red face is reversed and becomes green. And number two, Chairperson, on the issue of, because I can see that they've targeted the issue of the use of the ombuds plus the provincial authorities, the cooperation between the commission and those institutions. The question which a person has to ask, what is the strength of the commission compared to those institutions? Say, for example, we are having provincial authorities which deal with consumer affairs. When they look, they match their strength compared to those. Will it be advisable for us to refer our constituents to provincial authorities than the National Consumer Commission? Because, Chairperson, as I raised it the last time, when you put a complaint with the commission, 3 months down the line, there's no letter of receipt of that complaint or acknowledgement of that complaint, then you are in serious problem. So I think that where are they with the comparison between their strength and those of the provincial authorities? And then we'll come back in the second motion.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kadubi. Honourable Waiili, followed by Honourable
Thanks very much, Comrade Chair. The first question is on page 10, around the number of consumer awareness initiatives. I think there's a magnitude of a challenge, but how do you ensure that the effectiveness and the general spread in terms of those particular initiatives. But also we take note of the fact that the institution is in a kind of transition in terms of reconstruction. The second question is in page 12. Because in page 12, there are a number of meetings with stakeholders, and you have identified NEDLAC and RCS. But what becomes important, how does that information cascade down? Because at times you can meet different stakeholders at the boardroom level, but where it matters most is at the grassroots level, how to ensure that it becomes effective. Is there any strategy to work with a number of effective grassroots media, community media instruments in a form of community radio stations? Well, those are some of the effective measures, including the new phenomenon in terms of the community TV stations. But I must say that in terms of the current program, Ilungelo Lelakho, I can say that one is effective and is being listened by a number of people. Even myself, I've managed to pick up a number of points. The last one is in page 28, that several positions will be abandoned shortly. Is it a redundant? So what is the basis of and how many of those positions? Is that decision not going to impact in the institution? But I understand that not every position is critical and strategic in an institution, but we deserve a clarity on that particular aspect. Thanks very much, Comrade Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Waiili. Last member, Honourable Salah.
Comrade Chair, my first question is on page 13. I move from the premise that consumers are on the ground and the lowest level of addressing consumers is where they are. Page 13 says that there was a one meeting held with consumer protection forums involving provincial consumer protection authorities. Only one meeting thus far. What is the effect of this meeting? I view the importance of these structures and including local structures be established if needs be, in order to reach out to the consumer more effectively. Because without that, you are not reaching out to the consumer. We will be dealing more with the perception of what the consumer thinks than what the consumer really has as problems. On page 15, bullet number 1, 2, 3, 4, which says non-recurring irregular expenditure amounted to this. And I'm not very sure, that statement is not very self-explanatory as to what are these irregular expenditures. If we can get a little bit more information about that. Let's get to page 24. Page 24 is punching a lot of holes to the Consumer Council, really, and I'm not sure what you're doing about it. Bullet number 3 of the ACSA findings summary, which says these findings related to the absence of policies, revision of internal processes in supply chain management, finance, assets management, recruitment of personnel, big management and travel. That's why almost the entire organization. If we do not have mechanisms to make these particular areas of work function, there is no way we are going to
What is it that you are doing to rectify this particular kind of situation? Because with this situation in place, we are far from the destination towards which we want to find ourselves. And on the last is on page 28, not really the last chapter, but the last of the few, I think. The second bullet from the bottom, which says, which acknowledges the lack of skills in the LCC, but it also talks about internal training has been made compulsory on a weekly basis. How do you approach this training? Is it on-the-job training? Do you stop work and go take people for a one-day training for the whole day? What form does it take? What kind of training does it? Does it involve an outsider? I see it is written internal. Or do you train people by yourself? Who is training these people? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. And what we need to do with the NCC, we've got another 10 questions here, which are in writing. And you will take at your leisure this afternoon on the flight, respond to them, and then just email them as soon as you hit the land, you know, the ground, the top, and then you will the process. The reason why we're on acceleration mode, and this is all in your heads anyway, all in your heads, is that we're closing tomorrow and we want to be able to pass. So I'm just alerting you, and I'll give this to you, not to start dealing with it now, but, you know, on the plane, right? Now, Commissioner, if you can briefly respond to this so that we can start with the DTI's report no later than 11:05. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. May I ask my Deputy Commissioner to do the first question, please?
Thank you, Honourable Member, for the opportunity, and thank you, Commissioner. In terms of looking at the several complaints that you have received and whether how were they resolved and all that, looking at the complaints that we had received so far, is that we do not really have a sense as to in which trains are the complaints that we are receiving, because we haven't done the trains analysis as of yet. And this is really, it was kind of like a backlog, because we were more reacting than really analyzing and looking at the trains themselves. And what we are doing to try and protect the consumers as of now is that we are now trying to look at the categories of complaints that we are receiving, recording that by province as well, because we are a national office, we cannot say they come from this province. We are looking at indicators that we want to take. Those would include the area where they come from, the nature of the complaint, and the gender and also the race of the complainants and the type of the industry that they are complaining about. So we are trying to do this retrospectively in terms of looking at all the complaints that we have resolved as to where they come from, to categorize them. But moving forward, we are going to have a proactive way of actually categorizing them as they come in, and in that case, we have that information in our fingertips. And the second part is that on the complaints that we were receiving, the problem is that we did not filter. In terms of like when a complaint comes in from the beginning, we don't know exactly what type of complaint, whether we had jurisdiction over the complaint, or whether was the person included or excluded by the protection of the Act. And because we did not do this, so we had to receive everything, sit with that for like a week or so before it went to the analysis, because we did not have the skill to analyze it at that level. But for now, what we are doing, we have now developed what we call templates or script for the people that will be receiving the complaints, just to ask pertinent questions that will be able to filter complaints, so that we can there and there advise the consumer to say, yes, you are allowed to lodge a complaint with us, or maybe if it is a one-on-one complaint, like a person complaining about maybe a product that they bought from Game, because our resolution in terms of the Act is that a complaint should be resolved at the source. To ask just a simple question, did you go to game to say to them, this is what we have and what did they say before we take those complaints. So those are the things that normally are cause of issues that we could not address, but now in trying to understand the act, we see that we can do them better, but then we hope that in the next financial year, once we have put our house in order, dealt with the issue of our process flow and the issues of turnaround times to say when we receive a complaint, when do we register it, how do we categorize it, and what is the turnaround time, then we'll be able to say when we come here and say how many have we received and whose favor was it on. And this actually talks to the issues again of like if we go out there to address the communities, maybe in talking to some of the people to say workshops that we are conducting. For now, we did not have, yes, even if we would have had the opportunity, but what were we going to communicate with the different communities if we did not really understand the pertinent issues that the members of the community or in the different communities are struggling with? Because in that case, we'll just be addressing general issues. Because when you go out to the community, what is important is that the person that you are addressing, if they have consumer problems, you should be able to highlight those areas, try to address them and say, is it maybe the issue of understanding whether they don't understand their rights? Is it more about maybe products that they buy that are expired that they don't know exactly how to return to either the supplier? So those are the issues that are more, the chains themselves are more important to us to assist us to understand our consumers, package our messages, and also understand the type of complaints that we are dealing with per area, per category, and also per province. So I'll try and stop the question. Thank you.
Sorry, perhaps we'll deal with the next two or three questions with regards to the audit committee and the remedies available in the strings of the NCC.
Honourable Chair, the issue with regards to the dashboard, and more particularly, I think, raised by the WIP. Now, when one looks at the AG's report, it particularly refers to the lack of monitoring of compliance and the review thereof. It does not actually speak to the fact that there is processes in place. There is a whole host of internal controls. Remember, prior to the current commissioner taking office, there was no audit committee, there was no internal audit. All of these functions are now in place. Then the findings that were raised by the Auditor General predominantly were raised at the end of the previous financial year, the 76. And what has happened over the year, Honourable Chair, is that almost 80% of those findings have been dealt with. And it's just a mere, I think, 18% that has not been effectively implemented. But there are genuine reasons for that, Honourable Chair.
On the issue of the staffing itself, wherein we were talking about positions that we are going to abandon. In this case, when we could remember that with the history of the NCC, is that we had interns that were out of establishment. We found a proper job functions. And what we had done with the finances that we had received from the DTI is that we have now advertised those positions as administrative positions within the Complaints Resolution Department. They are all internal people that we are going to, not actually that we are going to let them go. We are going to move them into now advertised positions with clear functions and clear roles as to what is it that they need to do. And the training that now we are conducting internally, it is done by our own senior managers that have been part part of the drafting of the Act and understanding the Act. What we are doing is we release them every Wednesday for 1.5 hour. We alternate the groups so that we have people that are working. If this week this group is going for the training, is that we take them through the processes of what is expected in the Act, especially on the issues of like the filtering of the questions, asking the right questions to the consumer when they lodge a complaint, to say, does the person have a mandate, before you can even say to the person, come in, lodge your complaint. So those are, we are just doing the basic with them, so that when we absorb them into these positions with clear standards in terms of what is their role, what are the functions that they have to perform, at least we have done the basic of like, we know exactly that these people would be able to filter in and take people's questions.
Sorry, with regards to the meetings with stakeholders, meetings are held with stakeholders to discuss issues of common interest, common concern, how we can cooperate with each other, how we can have joint activities and so on. So those are the meetings that we have with the NRCS and other sister organizations and so on. But yes, there is a strategy with regards to taking the word out there to consumers with regards to the community radio stations. We, for instance, partnering with the National Consumer Forum, which is the probably the most vocal civil society body, NGO, that deals with consumer matters. And they've managed to secure the premises and the equipment of the GCIS to use as a venue from which we can then pass on that message to consumers and to then broadcast to several. Yeah. With regards to
thank you very much, Chair. Just in response, I think, to Honourable Wahili's question, we have established the Coty Communicators Forum, which is a joint partnership between the DTI and all its agencies, and there's a joint campaign planned with the NCC, the NCR, and the NRCS. A number of campaigns planned for the 14-15 financial year, and there's a joint campaign on World Consumer Rights Day planned for the 15th of March, and we're targeting all of the SABC, the public service radio stations, so Lesedi, Palapada, Tobele FM, I think there's about 7 or 8 of these radio stations that we are going to be using. Thank you, Chair.
Question on the communication, the speed with which you'll be able to respond in future. The speed. Not on the radio, of course, but, you know, the one-to-one. That's just a short intervention, is it, Honourable James?
I had a question about the inability of the NCC to put facts before us in terms of dealing with complaints. I mean, I'm flummoxed about that, and I think that, so I have something to say about that. So, but I just follow this answer to your question.
Thank you. Yes, Deputy Commissioner.
With the issue of us responding directly to persons, we have try to do that. I think with the 6,045 complaints that we have dealt with, I think those are actually backlog issues. And then in terms of the complaints that we are receiving, we did not really have had a very good track record in terms of having our turnaround times and established in terms of like to the managers and saying, when what is actually the real turnaround time in you responding, giving out the response and all that. Those we are working in right now in dealing with the complaints. And then what we would do in terms of giving you the examples in terms of like those other kind of like the businesses that we have, complaints that we have dealt with, the type of industries that we have, and whether they were in favor of the consumer or in favor of the retailer. I think that is an area wherein we can work around that and give a response to this committee in writing once we have went back to analyze that. But we hope that in future, with us dealing with those complaints, we have worked out proper turnaround times, so having a follow-up meeting to the chief directors on really dealing with the complaints issues and responding on time. And then I think it's a measure that we can be measured with in the next quarter. For now, because we are just trying to just redo and understanding our mandate better.
What we're going to do is we are going to leave it there for the moment. There are a number of questions here in writing which we've given to you, including this one of the analysis of complaints, the nature. But I'm sure it's all in the computer there. And just before we close off, you wanted to make a comment, Honourable James, or have you made your comment?
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity, because I mean, in our country, having taxpayers' money deal with consumer protection is a fundamental obligation. In wealthy countries, you know, you have Ralph Nader, and in the U.S. you just buy his magazine and you know which products are very good. But we are not the U.S. So for ordinary citizens, you are the only recourse to being protected against abuse and so on. So your mandate is a fundamentally important one. And I must say that I understand that you're trying to fix your problems right now and you are very internally focused. But you must never, ever lose sight of your external focus. You're responding to complaints, but I'm open to your mandate, but you should also be aggressive. You should also go out there and look and actually, you know, test for problems proactively and so on. So I'm really, really, really quite disturbed by the fact that I have no factual basis for making an assessment of how good a job you're doing. And if the minister decides to shut you down, would it make a difference? That's partly a humorous comment, but I mean, it's a real comment, you know. Would it make a difference to consumer protection if you existed or not? And so that has to be the test. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be harsh, but
I've given you that last point. Minister, can I allow Honourable Khadebe to speak before you come in there? Thank you.
Company Chairperson, it is very rare that the ANC agrees with the DA, in particular just before the election. This must be very good. But Chairperson, I think that the problems which are faced by the NCC are enormous, yeah? And then it needs all of us to put a shoulder on the wheel so that we really work on it. But at the same time, the NCC itself must do its bit, yeah? Because I think that even from the side of communication, there's some sort of a retrogression here. There's a regression on the issue of the way they communicate with the rural communities. Now, when you look at the input there, you can see that the issue of the rural dimension is out of the picture. Now, I think it's dangerous because that's where the need is high. That's where the need is high. It's really high here. And then on the issue of moving forward, Chairperson, I think the NCC, although they didn't respond to some, the issue of the relative strength now, between themselves and the provincial authorities, they didn't come through to that. But I think, Chairperson, because this is our last meeting with them as this portfolio committee, I think that for the incoming committee, Chairperson, it must still go and babysit this institution. I think that each and every quarter, they must come and present their progress report, because we cannot afford, because Chairperson, what has happened is that when the NCC was launched, high expectations were raised from the side of the communities. And then if they're not going to be fulfilled, Chair, it's going to be very bad for the country as a whole. Because what happens is that the business, they tend to plan around the challenges of their risk to report. So they fortify themselves. So if we're going to have a commission is not going to have equal strength to match that, then the consumers are going to be in big troubles here. So I think that the incoming committee, every quarter they must come and report here.
I'm going to just go straight to the minister because time is up.
No, Chair, I just popped them a note along the way saying I think that even if they haven't got all the information all analysed and quantified, they should give some examples of the work that has been done. I mean, I think that from where I sit, the oversight, what happened originally was that the commission was bombarded with a number of individual complaints, and some of them were taken up, and rather easily compliance orders were issued, which were then overturned in the National Consumer Tribunal, which was not actually helping consumers. So I think that what they tried to do is to build relationships with industry bodies and to delegate downwards. And some of that work I know has happened in the automotive sector, which is one of the areas where there have been complaints. I think another one is cell phones. But I think they should come back with some examples. And then I think another example where something has happened has been on the meat labeling issue. There's a new regulation on meat labeling, as you know, where a plain language, if I can recall it, description of the animal from which the meat is derived has to be included on the packages from, I can't remember when it was, but there was a certain time for the industry to adjust. So I think that what they should do, it is correct that the committee members want some examples of what has happened. I think that they'll have to come back, even if they can't give you X percent of our work was in this area, Y percent was in that area, and Y X comes from this province. But a couple of other things that I've suggested that they need to do is they need to find the synergies with the National Regulator Compulsory Specifications, where, for example, we find that the National Regulator continues to intercept paraffin stoves, which when they fall over, they catch fire. The national the minimum standard is when they fall over, they're supposed to go out. If they fall over and all the paraffin spills and it causes fires, and these things are sold in squatter communities, we know what happens. Lots of shacks get burned down, and these things are illegal. And I think that the Consumer Act is an additional ammunition because anybody who's involved in the value chain who supplies these things, if you go to consumers and say don't buy them, when they're a lot cheaper, they're going to buy them anyway. But if there is a fire, then the person who supplied and everybody down the wholesaler, the importer, the whole lot, are also liable under the Consumer Act. So I think that's just an example of the kind of synergies that I think these two institutions need to find with each other. So I do hope that they, when you get your written answers, that they will give some examples of some of the work they've done. Thanks.
I think, Minister, that would be helpful. But as I think the whip has indicated, as this is our last meeting or engagement as this committee, it will be important that we take on board the point that you have just made, as well as get the responses to the balance of these. And had you been here, I know you would have responded, you know, had more time. But we allocated an hour, you know, and thought that would be sufficient. But our main concern remains one of the issues we raised right at the beginning, 18 months ago, the need to work with the provinces was one of the many issues. And that would appear not to become fully operational. By that, I mean, you know, you're utilizing them in the manner that we thought could have supported your work. But what we would like to say is that you certainly have addressed the backlogs, and I think that's to be commended. And I don't think anyone would disagree on that point. But now we've got to get to a little bit, go deeper than that. You know, we can't be stuck in a retro mode. You know, we've got to move forward now. And that's really what we are saying. And, you know, it is very rare that the ANC and DA agree on such principles. But I think what it does show is that there is a unanimity in that your organization, your commission, is vitally important for our country. And we simply wanted to work effectively, as you pointed out, Deputy Commissioner and Commissioner and the COO, there is a need to have a clear understanding of the mandate and to implement it more robustly. You know, just pull out, use some of those rock violet teeth of yours, Commissioner. All right. I mean, I don't know. Hopefully you've got some. Yeah. Thank you very much, Commissioner. And we have appreciated working with you and your team. Thank you very much. And for your transparent approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Committee, we'll have what's called a little bit of a rolling tea break. So there's no actual tea break per se. You just roll out, roll back. And then we're going to go straight into the minister's input. Because I think, look, we want to get to the meat of our mandate as well. And I noticed that there's quite a job pulling that up, and I do. But I'd like to welcome officially once again the Minister of Trade and Industry, Dr. Rob Davies, the DG, Sir Lionel October, DDGs, several of you here, and ask the Commissioner just to make a little way for his colleagues. I know I said you were vitally important, but I didn't want you to glue yourself to the seat. we can move a bit. All right. Now, the way we're going to do this, members, is to allow the minister to really go with it. Note your questions. And then we'll have a break, and then we can thunder forth with our engagement. So, Minister, it's over to you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. I think what we thought we should do here is present what I think we can style a close-out report from this administration on the key highlights of the work which we've done. I'm going to not go through every slide and every bullet, but we're going to offer a pack for members of the committee to keep with them. I'm just going to highlight a few very, very broad directions of the work. But what we're basically doing is to just look quite briefly at the priority dimensions and some of the achievements over the last 5 years. What we are focusing on to begin with is that we have, under this administration, said that the fundamental priority is industrialization and the promotion of industrialization. That's the core mandate of this department, encapsulated in the industrial policy action plans, and that it is also the policy framework that shapes a number of our other programs in the department, because it's an extremely broad department, as you all know. So there's a bit on broadening economic participation, that is the small business co-op and empowerment division. Then also trade investment instruments to support industrialization. That will be very brief on the work of the International Trade Economic Development Division, but a little bit more on the work of Trade Investment South Africa, TISA, which is investment and trade promotion. The regulatory environment, again, quite brief, that's CCRD, where the DDG, Zodwa and Thuli, sitting next to us here. And then we thought that we ought to put in a few ordinary operational indicators, which we have always wanted to monitor and see continuous improvement in. So let me move very, very quickly, and I'm not actually going to talk to the next two or three slides. It is about the context. And I think that we need to understand something of the context, that we took office in the background of the worst global economic crisis any time since the 1930s. It struck us in a wave of seismic shocks, a number of them, the first one being the recession and job losses, where we lost 1 million jobs, 20% of those were in manufacturing. Then we had
as a result of quantitative easing in the developed world, we had an overvalued currency, which had a perverse effect of stimulating imports and making exports more difficult, at the same time as exports were already difficult because of depressed demand in the developed world. We then had the end of the commodity super cycle, and now we have the reverse of the overvalued currency with the move towards tapering, as it's called in the United States, and the return of hot money to the developed world. And I think that the only point I'd really want to make here is that the figure for manufacturing, 20% of the jobs were lost in manufacturing. Manufacturing is not 20% of the GDP. That means that there was more than a proportionate loss of jobs in manufacturing. And I think that I would want to contend that had we not done the things that we had done, we would have been sitting here now talking about serious deindustrialization of the South African economy. And the fact that we are not owes quite a lot to the work which we've done. So the next few slides, I think, are just showing some of the statistics around that. One of the ones which I didn't mention particularly is, of course, that what we do have as a result of the currency fluctuations as well, but is a serious current account deficit on the balance of payments, and that is that continues to be with us even though the currency shifted. We'll produce a correction over time, but we're still sitting with that challenge. Then I'm not going to go through this. I think you know the arguments that we have put forward around industrialization. Maybe most of the jobs in the economy won't come from industrialization, but the jobs that will come in services will be much more strongly rooted and much higher quality if they are linked to a diversifying value-added economy, and that therefore industrialization is critical. When the current iteration of ICAP comes out, you will see there's a few graphs there which are showing the job multipliers that come from the different industrial subsectors, jobs that are created in other parts of the economy as a result of the growth and development of industrial subsectors. And then I think that we were just putting down here that we have identified that industrial policy, active nurturing and support is fundamental to industrialization, that ICAP has also sought, the ICAPs have been seeking stronger conditionalities and reciprocal obligations from beneficiaries, and that we have, over this administration, we have sought to put in place regular, every year we have an ICAP at the start of the financial year, covering the financial year in question and then the two next ones, the outer years, and every year we issue one, and we are expecting that this year we will issue the sixth of these ICAPs. This is just saying some of the achievements, because the ICAPs identify both transversal, or if you want, cross-cutting areas where we intervene or act to support industry as a whole, and then there are also sector-specific programs and interventions using some of these, but also other particular support measures which may have been identified in sector programs. So here we are saying that the transversal ones, procurement. This has been one of the big, I think, new areas of work, where we have the one thing we have done is under the Triple PFA, the Preferential Procurement Framework Act, we have introduced a new note which is called designations, where we indicate that purchases by all organs of state at all spheres of government will have to come from local sources according to specific percentages which are indicated in practice notes which are issued by National Treasury, coming from work which is done by the DTI. And we have designated 11 sectors or products. These have been a range of, if you like, regular purchases by government entities such as workwear, uniforms, foodstuffs in hospitals and correctional facilities, but also very particularly intervention and designations that are linked to the infrastructure program. So one of the ones is buses, where we've designated bus bodies. As late as 2010, all the buses that were procured for the FIFA World Cup were all fully imported. Since then, we've seen 300 buses, bus bodies manufactured in South Africa for procurements for the bus rapid transit programs of different municipalities. And then there's also been locomotives, 1,000 locomotives locally manufactured, 2,600 railway wagons, but then also things like transmission equipment and so on. Then the Renewable Energy and Independent Power Producer Program, there's also been levels of local content that have been set there, rising from quite a low base to a higher level. And there is the level of investments. I mean, I think that from our point of view as the DTI, we have seen the Renewable Energy Program on a scale which is sufficiently large to support local industrial development. That's what we've been supporting. That's what it is about. It is, in fact, the largest renewable energy program on the African continent. Then we've introduced a local content verification office in the Bureau of Standards, because some of the problems we had with some of these were differential use of standards and then entities deciding that they were going to procure imported products. So we've introduced a new technical instrument and a local content verification office so that people can get a local content verification certificate. And then in addition to that, because we are not allowed under WTO rules to try to impose anything like this on the private sector, but we have through instruments like the localization accord with social partners, we have all agreed on a aspirational target of 75% local procurement, including local procurement by the private sector. So we have been supporting proudly South Africa stepping up its localization campaigns and also encouraging the delivery on the social accord. Industrial financing, that has been a big issue. We identified that all successful emerging economies that are industrializing have had active industrial finance, development finance institutions. We compared, if you recall, the first IPAP, we compared the IDC and the BNDES in Brazil. What's happened is that there has been work done in the IDC. It has leveraged its balance sheet and released an additional 100 million rand, and 50.8 billion of that, which has created 130,000 jobs, has been in IPAP sectors. And there's also been a fund to boost youth entrepreneurship. Then, as a result of our learnings, I think particularly our learnings in the clothing sector, where we saw an important turnaround based on a support for competitiveness raising, we introduced the Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program, which is our big ticket industrial incentive, because we are responsible for industrial incentives on budget. MFEP came into existence in 2012. We've approved awards to 413 entities with an investment value of 12 billion rand, which has helped to sustain 110,000 jobs. There you can see the sectors. The biggest one is agro-processing, and then followed by metals and chemicals. Then there's the 12i tax incentive, which is for investment. And this has got, I think you probably know, it's got different categories. You get a higher tax break for greenfield and brownfield, and there's an additional amount for training. And we've offered 20 billion rands worth of tax breaks, and that is supporting 32 billion rands of investment. The Manufacturing Investment Program, it's approved since 2008, 1,856 projects with a total incentive value of 4.9 billion rand and investments of 35 billion with the creation or support of 43,000 jobs.
the cooperative incentive scheme. You know that there's the new act and there'll be new institutions coming into place, but the cooperative incentive scheme has supported 1,202 applications with incentive paid out of 286 million rand. And we've supported 184 co-ops in various places in different provinces. They are the figures. The film incentive is one where we've seen a sizable increase and I think a serious deepening and strengthening of the local film industry with bigger film production, more local content, the success of things like the Cape Town Film Studio, which we've also been supporting. And there are some of the films. I think Long Walk to Freedom was the probably the flagship film from South African stables to date. Then we've been looking at issues like illegal imports, and there have been a number of measures there, but one of them has been customs fraud. We've introduced a number of measures there, based on really recognition that we have to have an intelligence-driven system, but one of the things that we have begun to introduce now is a reference price system for the clothing industry in particular. So the customs officers, where they see a declaration of a shirt valued at this and it's way below the reference price, they know it can't be the correct price. That has also had an impact on higher levels of declarations. We had a huge difference between declared values of imports and declared values of exports in some of the exporting countries, meaning there was significant under-invoicing. But we've had a billion rands worth of illegal or substandard goods to be confiscated, and the SARS modernization program, which is including much more sophisticated methods of trying to identify risk and then acting on risk, has begun to pay off, although let's be honest, we haven't yet cracked this problem. We still continue to face a huge problem of illegal imports, and I think what we have really not done yet is, I've often said, you don't get a free pass if you manage to smuggle your goods through the border. If you sell them, you also still are committing an offence, and we haven't really managed to crack down on that yet at this point. Then we have introduced a developmental approach to tariff setting, which is informed by industrial development needs. That is, there have been a number of, it's not only tariff increases, we've also done some tariff decreases, like in steel, a number of rebates where we have manufacturing capabilities depends on rebates. We've taken from the backwaters, I think, of the DTI, the technical infrastructure institutions, or if you want SQAM, the Standards Quality Assurance and Metrology, and we have taken them because we think that increasingly in trade, increasingly in defending our consumers, but also our industries against unfair competition, the role of these bodies is very, very important, and they have played an important role in, as the slogan goes, locking in South African exports to markets abroad and locking out from the South African markets unsafe and unfair competition from substandard products. Competition policy, there's been a step up in actions by the competition authorities, which report to EDD, but these are some examples. I think you can see the construction one was the kind of highlight, but there have been some very important ones in the food sector, and there is also a market inquiry into private healthcare, which will be a very important investigation going on in due course. Then I'm not going to go through this one because I think you all know it. IDZs and the SEZs, the committees have been dealing with the bill. You all know the bill was cleared the last hurdle in Parliament last week. It's now the President for assent. We have been seeing traction in a number of the IDZs. I was at Cook on Sunday, and I think we see there as well there's some traction taking place. East London, there's been some very serious traction taking place. Richards Bay is beginning to move, and Saldanha was proclaimed as an IDZ last year, and we have something like 6 to 8 investors in Saldana. I think it's 8 and 6 of them have signed up. I think that's quite a significant progress which is taking place there. And this oil and gas sector is becoming quite important, even on the East Coast. When I was in Kuka, I saw in the port of Luka, they had a rig which was coming from the East Coast, as well as the servicing from the West Coast. Then some of the sectoral programs. I'm not going to go through this very much. The automotive sector, we have made the transition from the Motor Industry Development Program to the Automotive Production Development Program. That transition has taken place. We are also now supporting not just the production of passenger vehicles, but also medium and heavy commercial vehicles, as well as public transport vehicles. Public transport vehicles, both in the form of taxis, as well as in the form of bus bodies, which I already mentioned. We front-loaded the automotive investment scheme, which is part of the APDP, and that was really one of the things that got investment going after the recession. And we've actually approved through the AIS 200 projects with a total investment value of 26 billion rand, which will support 56,000 existing jobs and create an additional 21,000 jobs in the auto sector. That also includes auto components. Then on clothing and textiles, here I think one of the big turnarounds, I think this is the sector where I think if we had not done anything, we would have been kissing the sector goodbye, and quite a number of people were telling us we might as well kiss the sector goodbye. We didn't take that view. We took the view that we had a capability in South Africa. We had an advantage of being close to the retailers. We could build on fast fashion and fast turnaround. We did an analysis, and we found that the incentive that was in place called the duty credit certificate was having a perverse effect, because those who were earning duty credit certificates were selling them to retailers who were then importing more. They weren't being used to acquire machinery equipment and upgrade productivity. We were finding too many firms which were just sweating the assets, waiting for the circumstances to be so adverse, then close the factory and fire the workers. And so we changed it to the competitiveness program. And as I said already, it was a big learning from this that led to the introduction of the MCEP, Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program. Two dimensions to that. There was the competitiveness program and the other one, I forgot the name now, which we've been using to support clusters. But we've seen 777 applications with a value of 2.2 billion have been approved under the production incentive, with 63,000 jobs saved and 8,000 new jobs created. Now, if we can create 8,000 jobs in clothing and textile, we can create jobs across manufacturing. The share of locally produced clothing has remained around the 25 to 30% mark, despite fierce international competition. And increasing penetration of illegal imports, so we think that that's quite an achievement. There have been a number of cases of textile factories gearing up, clothing factories gearing up because of the contracts that they have obtained. Even, I saw some notes I got, even things like producers of fire person's equipment that used to be imported. Our local companies are beginning to get into this space. And then we've seen in the footwear sector, I think the footwear industry a few years ago, people would have told you it was dead in the water. And we're now seeing that that there is a substantial improvement in the production of footwear. I went to the factories in the Southern Cape, where I can see that there is actually quite a lot of optimism, both because they're producing footwear, which is workwear related, and also other general footwear. Green industries, I said already, we moved to green industries, solar water heaters, wind tower production, PV structures and assembly. And there's quite a number of these. Sunday we were there for the launch of this DCD investment in wind tower manufacturing in Kuka. But we've seen that there's been growing localization in these areas, in growing investments. Business process services, we changed the incentive. It used to be based on capital expenditure. It's now based on operational expenditure. We've emerged as a very competitive destination for our BPS. I'll come to some of the awards we've received. We've attracted 5.9 billion rands of investments with about 9,000 jobs created. And there are some of the firms that have invested in the third bullet. And then linked to that has been this Monyetla work readiness program, where we've been training people to become BPS agents. One thing that we should mention is that we introduced a requirement that 80% of the jobs that would be created from all the new incentives would have to be young people, because this is really an area where you have entry into a career in offices. And I'm pleased to say that I was able to report at the Presidential Youth Summit that actually the investments that have happened since then have been 85% young people. Agro-processing, you'll recall earlier that under MSEP it was the biggest sector. 1 billion rand has been supporting various agro-processing projects. We've been talking to agro-processing sector quite a bit over the last few days. There is, I think, progress in agro-processing across the board, and a desire on the part of agro-processors to increase their local content. Some of the agro-processors are processing already existing agricultural produce. Some of them, like, for example, the Ndonsa plant in Durban, which we launched a few years ago, during COP17, Unilever plant, they make all kinds of soups and spices and things, and 50% is currently local. They have a target of moving it to 100%. We've been working on the small-scale billing project, which we launched a few years ago, which has the real potential to bring maize milling into small communities and also reduce the price of maize to local consumers, because they pay at the moment a transport cost, taking the maize from where they are now to Gauteng, having it milled, and then bringing it back again. Then we've launched a number of campaigns, Eat Well, Eat Safe, Eat Local. It doesn't say Eat Local, but we've been launching that because there are going to be new food safety regulations in South Africa, and we want to get the local manufacturers to position themselves so that they can use that as an advantage, that they will be producers of healthy food. That means less fat, less salt, less sugar. And then we've launched the aquaculture development program, and there's some figures about the number of aquaculture, huge opportunities. We are very, very behind, even a number of other countries on the African continent. We're behind Egypt, we're behind Nigeria, we're even behind Malawi. But there's a number of real opportunities for aquaculture projects, both inland and also at the sea. There are some projects that are beginning to take off in aquaculture. I didn't realize until I got involved in this that 50% of the world's fish is now coming from aquaculture sources rather than wild. Metal fabrication. Well, one of the things that we've done here is that together with EDD, we've been working on a regime to make sure that we get more scrap metal, which is often called the resource above the ground, available to support local steel making and to create more competition in the local steel industry. There is now a new regime in place where you have to demonstrate that the export wasn't stolen property, that it is actually the metal you claim it to be and not illegally mined gold or something. And also then there's a 20% price advantage for the local market. I was at Kuka on the weekend, as I said, and one of the projects there is something called Agni Steel, which is using scrap metal and is benefiting from this. And we'll be producing steel products for the construction industry in South Africa. We've seen there that there's a number of initiatives around the Tool Initiative, National Tool Initiative, National Foundry Initiative, but the big driver here is the supply development by the state-owned companies and the designations that have gone along with that, where we've seen that their competitive supply development programs have resulted in multi-billion rand rail procurement programs. And we can see companies, also Bay Transforming Scrap Metal, we can see companies that are beginning to produce railway wheels and things of that sort. So there's a take-up in a sector where we used to have capacity, we lost capacity, we're now beginning to regain our capacity. Now, some of the challenges, I want to go through those quite quickly. We still have the effects of the recession. We still have the effect of currency volatility. We've identified monopolistic pricing, and I think lack of appropriate supply development by big companies in the sector. So we still are grappling with issues like the steel price. We have not managed to solve that. We've also got, on top of that, bunched up administered prices. We managed to solve a few of those, for example, the price of port charges. We need to address issues of intergovernmental coordination, environmental regulations, and then skills deficits and labor relations volatility. I think that, for example, the motor strike, one of the issues there in the motor strike was that a number of the motor manufacturers said, well, if they had a single three-week strike, would have been okay, but they had one first in the OEMs, then another one followed that in the component manufacturers. So I think the issues like that. The opportunities, we think the opportunities for industrialization arise from local procurement and supply development. That is something which I think we're indicating in really the current IPAP, but also in the next one. We need to step up our work on that. Beneficiation, well, we have to see what happens with the Mineral Petroleum Resources Development Act amendments about a developmental price for mineral products. But in the meantime, we've identified a number of serious opportunities, some of those in the work that's been done around the special economic zones, for example, around platinum, but not only platinum for jewelry and automotive exhaust systems, but also for hydrogen fuel cell technology, particularly small power stations. What we need to do, this is one of the things that I think we're beginning to say, is that we need to have a much more granular engagement with larger companies, and we need to strengthen the conditions that we extract as we provide an increasing quantum of incentives. We've been providing these incentives. In some cases, we've been extracting conditions. For example, in the automotive incentive scheme, there are two scales. You get 20% or 30%. Nobody wants 20% to get 30%. You have to show increased performance in jobs and local procurement. Infrastructure development, I think, is absolutely fundamental. It's our main counter-cyclical response, but also it's a major driver of industrialization. Natural and shale gas, learn some of the lessons of the United States, which has been reindustrializing based on cheap energy. We've said as government that the shale gas, if we have it on the scale that has been predicted, would potentially be a game changer with cheaper energy, but gas generally is a cheap energy resource, even if we import it. I think that we are in the process of rolling out the exploration permits. Regional integration and new export markets. A lot of our trade work has been driven by the sense that we need to broaden integration on the African continent and create the large regional markets which can support industrialization, not just in South Africa, but across the African continent. In BRICS, a number of opportunities arising in BRICS. Let me just give one, that in the BRICS Business Council, which has been meeting, the possibility of a collaboration in the aircraft industry has been raised, we have capacity. I went to a project which was Aerosud in the Centurion Aerospace Village, and we were going to buy the Airbus A20M military plane. We decided not to. and we lost any kind of offset preferences, they put that, that out to open tender, and Aerosuit won on open tender, producing wingtips and cabin components. We have capacities to manufacture aircraft components. And with BRICS, I think we have opportunities. China has an aircraft industry, so does Brazil. Then, broadening economic participation. Well, CEDA has a network of 43 branches, 18 mobile units, and 50 information kiosks. We've identified a number, we've hosted a number of important conferences, for example, the International Small Business Conference, where we announced one of the incentives that's coming up, the Incubation Support Program. We've done quite a lot of work across this. We have an SMME payment hotline, 30-day payments, often a complaint, and I'm very proud to say that the DTI has the number of valid invoices for SMMEs that are not paid is zero, nil, zilch, nada. We have paid everything. But we've also facilitated more than 2 billion rand, nearly 3 billion rand of late payments through this hotline. We have an integrated framework and action plan, which was approved by MINMEC. We're going to be launching at the end of this week in Port St. John's something called the National Informal Business Upliftment Strategy, NIBUS, and this will be aimed at businesses that remain in the informal sector, where we support them to formalize and improve, but without any conditionalities, with a focus on support for infrastructure. And then we've had a red tape reduction guidelines of municipalities, and we are trying to reduce red tape, which we understand to mean unnecessary regulation, costly reporting requirements, duplications, and things of that sort. Co-op development, well, we've passed the Co-op Act with the support of the committee, and we hosted the BRICS Co-op meeting. Incubation support program, we launched this. We've been rolling out incubators through CEDA, but also what we've decided to do, and we launched this during the national, the International Small Business Conference, we offer an incentive. We offer support to private sector incubation programs, and here you see Sasol. We're the first one, was at the Sasol Chemical City, which we launched, so we turned the sod on that. And there's also a number of others in the being rolled out. There's the numbers that are in the pipeline. That's the number of incubators that are currently operating, 42. This is the support program. These are support programs. This is one in the ICT sector in Johannesburg. Because what we've taken the view is that incubation, if we are going to industrialize the country and we are going to create small businesses, we want small businesses that are actually operating in the productive sector. And one of the models which has been highlighted and mentioned as a direction of industrialization appropriate not just to South Africa but Africa is the Asian model. We have a strong symbiotic relationship between big and small companies, where big companies work with small companies as suppliers. And that's why incubation in the private sector, we've taken a view that that's very important. And you'll see later on that's one of the reasons why we have put that down as a sub-minimum in the BEE codes, because we want many more big companies to be involved in active mentoring, support, and incubation of small companies that will then become their suppliers. On women and gender empowerment, a few of the highlights here. The Techno Girls program, which has been strongly associated with Deputy Minister Tabeti, who's down there in the bottom picture. This has been in operation for 7 years. Every year at the budget vote, the Techno Girls come along. And we've had 1,210 girls who've been basically shown the opportunities that exist in the world of business and technology, and a number of those are going to come through as women entrepreneurs. Then, in addition to that, we have the Bagumeni Skills Development Program, which is supporting skills development and formal training among women. And 434 women in 9 provinces have been trained through this program. There's the Isivandi Women's Fund, which is providing particular support for women, but with a rural focus, supporting 33 projects with a value of more than 22 million since 2012-13. On BE, the remaining institution of the BE that was not in existence under the 2003 Act was activated in this administration. That was the Advisory Council. There's a picture of the chairperson of the Advisory Council, who is the President of the Republic, at the session of the Advisory Council. We've, of course, passed the bill, and we have, in addition to that, we have changed the codes. We held a summit. The codes were gazetted on October. We've given an extension for the compliance of the codes. They've now got 18 months to comply with the new codes. The Amendment Act has been assented to, and there's been a management development program with some of the institutions. We have a youth development strategy in the DTI. This is in response to, well, all of the work of government and the signatory of the signing of the Youth Employment Accord. I think we've taken the view that there isn't a magic bullet to solve the huge challenges of youth unemployment, but rather there needs to be an integrated set of responses covering a number of things across the economy. And our particular role has been, one of them I've mentioned, is to have set aside in some of the existing programs. I mentioned that in BPS. But another one is youth entrepreneurship and youth cooperatives. And we've been rolling that out with the youth chief directorate that we have in broadening participation. Our strategy was launched last year. And then this picture here is something which we launched last week, which is Itukisi program, which means prepare yourself, because one of the things that we discovered was even if you have what happens is if you don't have secondary education, you're in a very large pool for a shrinking number of jobs. If you have secondary education, the pool's down a bit, but you're still in a very difficult situation. If you have post-school qualifications, you are much better off. Tertiary education, most of the jobs that have been created are for people with tertiary qualifications. But actually, you have a 2.3 times better chance of getting a job if you've had work experience. And so this is, we launched this at Kaput, Cape Peninsula University of Technology, the old PENTEC, the campus out in Belleville. We launched this there. That's one of the beneficiaries. And there's 71 million rand that's going to be available to support internship programs in ICAP sectors, in industry basically. It's part of a bigger program which higher education training is responsible for, which is supporting internships in other parts of the economy. Then strategic use of trade and investment instruments. Well, I think you know tariff policies. I'm not going to go through that. I already mentioned that. Cracking down on under-invoicing and illegal imports. We've also been strengthening the work on scram institutions. We have our fundamental and most important trade negotiation process has been in the African continent, where we have, I think, had a huge debate, and we played a very active role in this debate, where de facto the priority for African integration at this moment in time is broadening integration across existing regional communities, creating large FTAs, but within a concept of development integration, where infrastructure investment becomes critical to join up our economies one to another, and where we also cooperate to promote industrialization across the continent. As far as the tripartite FTA is concerned, we probably are not going to make the deadline, which the heads of state told us 3 years from 2011. I must say, as trade ministers, we said 3 to 5 years.
So we don't think it's a train smash. Well, I don't think it's a train smash. But 3 years was very ambitious. But we've made a lot of progress. We've identified that we are not reopening trade negotiations with any existing regional communities. We are focusing on building trade relations with countries that don't, with whom we don't have any preferences. In our case, or SACU's case, that means with East African Community and Egypt, fundamentally. That's fundamentally what it means. We also agreed that on an architecture, there will be 60% duty-free on entry into force, a further 25% that has to be, what will be phased in over 5 to 8 years. That will be the architecture of the free trade agreement, and we're now in the process of receiving and developing offers. That's where we're at. So progress has been made. We also, during this tenure, we joined BRICS, which I think is a very substantial achievement. BRICS is the most important grouping of developing countries in the world, whatever other acronyms there may be, coined by people from all sorts of companies. The reality is that BRICS is an organization that is building on its internal cooperation agenda. A number of things in the BRICS that are in the report in the realm of trade industry. One of them is that the BRICS Business Council was launched. We were the first chairs of it. It had a face-to-face meeting. I participated in that. But also it's been meeting regularly by phone, and there will be a report. I mentioned one of the areas of potential cooperation in the aircraft industry. We've also been working quite energetically on promoting not just quantitative increases in trade, but actually also highlighting promotion of value-added trade and cooperation among ourselves. On investment, the performance agreement said that we had a quantitative target of achieving, attracting FDI to the value of 115 billion between 2009-10 to 2013-14, and this is the what we have actually, the investment pipeline, there it is in different years, and that comes to considerably, was added up at one stage, it seems to be added up now, that is considerably in excess of the target. There are some of the examples of some of the projects that have been facilitated. This is the work of TISA. I think that the TISA pipeline is a very good very good indicator, because while you can come here and just set up if you feel like it, not many foreign investors actually just want to do that. They want to know what is the regulatory environment, what are the incentives available, and they do tend to work with TISA around those issues. So here are a few of them. We have Heineken, we have the Indonesia project. That was, I think, a very important statement, that one. Unilever saw the African continent as a place where they have to grow. They don't see their home base in Europe as creating any more opportunities for expansion there. They see South Africa as critical. That plant, I went to launch that one in at the time of the COP17, because it was put out as the most advanced plant in the Unilever stable, and it was advanced also in terms of green technology. Nothing in the municipal rubbish dump, no water from the municipal system, and very high levels of energy efficiency. Then here are a number of other companies in the agro-processing and domestic products. Here we see them all beginning to set up and expand the operations in South Africa, and also some plants there like television manufacturing. Rambaxi is pharmaceuticals. There's some of the things in the water sector, and then some resource-based foreign investments that have taken place as well. A number of them in the green economy. I mentioned the DCD wind, but there's several others. Poway is also in Kruger, but several of these have been located across the country. And then there are the BPO companies that have invested in business process services. Some of it is call centers, but some of it is also other back office work
done through ICT. Some awards. TISA was elected Executive Vice President of the World Association of Investment Promotion Agency, so somebody thinks we're okay. We were Financial Times Best Investment Destination 2013 and 14 in Africa. We were the UK Outsourcing Association Offshoring Destination of the Year in 2012. And in 2013, we were the European, the whole of the EU, offshoring. And then we got an award for the second best investment project in Dubai. That was a pharmaceutical investment. Exports, this is some of the work that's done. Again, exporters can do whatever they like, but what we tend to do as governments is quite often explore export opportunities, particularly in new markets ahead of the market, and quite often lead the market. So export sales with a value of 10 billion rand, facilitated through 103 pavilions, 173 trade missions, and 23 investments and trade initiatives in six countries. Some of these are done by TISA itself, by the DTI itself, some of them also at a higher level by president or deputy president presidential visits. We've sought to diversify our strategy with a stronger focus on fast-growing emerging economies. We've searched out opportunities all over the world. We've gone Africa as our priority, but also Southeast Asia. We've been in ASEAN countries, the Middle East and the Gulf, huge opportunities there, and in Latin America. And we've also been, of course, building on our relations with BRICS, but not ignoring the EU. In the EU, I think we've been focusing on the members of the EU, the new members of the EU, with whom we have effectively an FTA, but with whom we don't have big existing relations. So the Eastern European countries, some of them like Poland. I think it's next week the Deputy President leading a delegation, a reciprocal visit to Poland. The Polish were here last year. There we've seen our exports to BRICS have gone up very substantially, with China emerging as our number one trading partner. But the thing we've been doing there is we've been actually trying to argue with them that if you look at the makeup, we import value-added products from them by and large, and we export primary products to them. So we've been actually focusing on promoting value-added products, and we see them becoming a little more prominent in our trade basket. And there are some of the pavilions and some of the activities we've done in various countries on the African continent. There are some figures year by year for the different companies that are supported, the different value of exports, pavilions, and missions. You'll see later on there's our new export strategy, exporter strategy, exporter development strategy, because one of the things is that you don't just sort of trot along on a trade mission and come back with a contract. You actually have to do quite a lot of preparatory work and develop capacity. So that's what we've been doing, is supporting companies to become export ready, to support, give trade information and export advice to a number of companies. And then trade leads that we've disseminated, where we think there are opportunities and we go and tell people. Awareness building and capacity building, it's all down there. Then the Export Council model was reviewed and finalized, and then that's what I was referring to, the National Exporter Development Program, which is to create a recognizable, global exporter passport initiative, so we can recognize where exporters are in terms of their ability to export and support them to become more export ready. Then regulatory environment, this is CCRD. I think that there's a general statement up there about what we require. Competition policy is, as I said, run by EDD, but it has been stepped up quite significantly. Companies and Consumer Protection Act are some of the two important highlights. You've already been discussing the consumer protection. I'm not going to say anything about that. But I think the Companies Act and related to that, the Companies Intellectual Property Commission, I think that we had a lot of unease when it came to, remember that there was, if we implemented the Companies Act, the world was going to come tumbling down. We needed a long period. And we took the decision, no, we'll do it. And we did it. And we also handed, I think, a very significantly poisoned chalice to the new Companies and Intellectual Property Commission, because the old CIPRO, not under the interim leadership, but before that, had been, I think, badly run. And we had a huge problem with an ICT contract, which was tainted, as you recall. We handed all that over to the Companies Intellectual Property Commission, and I think what we've seen is we've seen continuous improvement. I keep using this word because I think very seldom are there magic bullets. Mostly it's about continuous improvement. That's the Asian business model. You see continuous improvement, small improvement each year, and then you look back and, gee whiz, we've come a long way. And I think we're beginning to see some of that with the Companies Intellectual Property Commission. Not out of the woods yet, but considerable improvement. Then the other one I was saying to you was the general management of the institution. This is the work of GSSD, Group Services Division, and the DVG Sarah Chwani, and there are some of the figures. The establishment, well, we've seen a 15% increase in the establishment. We've seen the vacancy rate, which was 18%, has gone down to 9%, it's about half. Women in the senior management, we've seen that increase, well, marginally, but it's not 50%, but it's within striking distance of 50%. People with disability, the target is 2%. We were way below that. We're now a little bit over that. Those are just some graphs that are showing those two things and what's happened over the 5 years. There are the various incentives in numbers. 15,000 projects in those incentives. 143 million rand of investment that they facilitated across the board, 144,000 jobs created and 200,000 jobs supported. Then some indicative directions. I think I've already mentioned quite a bit of this, regional industrial integration, new export markets. We think that's quite critical work. I think we're looking ahead, as it were. BRICS, we need to develop more complementarities, more integrated value chains. We need to strengthen transversal and sector-specific interventions. A greater emphasis on a focused export promotion strategy. A greater emphasis on science, innovation, and technology. And more interface with DST. We are actually working quite well with DST now in a number of areas. This phrase, the new machine age, comes from a book which I read recently from two MIT economists who are basically talking about the impact of digitization. But we're going to see a huge amount more of this recombinative innovation and a huge premium on innovation, raising our bar on innovation. Stronger leverage in a public procurement and support and securing support from the private sector for localization. We need to, again, up our game on industrial financing and incentives, but also then to extract reciprocal obligations from people that benefit from us. And then beneficiation, this is the one which we think is fundamental. We don't have a competitive advantage any longer in South Africa from cheap energy. We lost that a few years ago. So what do we have as a real competitive advantage? Well, one of the things we have is availability of important industrial minerals, but those must be available at an appropriate price to support industrialization, as well as if we have significant quantities of shale gas, And some of the work tells us it could be very significant. Just to give an example, the work that's been done without any active exploration says we have got between 35 and over 400 trillion cubic feet of shale gas. Moss gas has one, and Mozambique, northern Mozambique, the new gas fields there have got 100. So if we have anything like 400, it would be a major game changer in the South African economy. So that's why we've taken the decision that we need to go into responsible exploration of the possibilities that we have the shale gas in this country, explore in such a way that we don't create environmental damage. So I think that is basically a handover of the closeout report, and I've gone through it as quickly as I can. I hope I haven't taken too much time, but let me stop at this point. Thank you very much, Chair.
No, that was very succinct. Thank you very much, Minister. Members, we're having a 5 to 7 minute comfort break, so the hands can go down. We'll be back here, or certainly I will, and the Minister, at 12:15 to continue. It's now just after 5:05.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm going to go to the phone. manufacturing is that if we're going to grow, we are going to need every single South African, even if their skin colour is green. The final question, which is just, is look, I see on page 23 we've got another acronym, so they must put it in, called NABLES or something. And then we've got the Red Tape Reduction System. Now in Afrikaans they've got a wonderful word for red tape, it's called the ROMP SLOMP. So maybe you should bring in a new acronym. No, that's only joking, called CROMP SLOMP, for cut the red tape. So that is one suggestion. And then the last question is, there's a bill before Parliament on private investment, reducing it, and there's an introduction of a new word called deprivation in Clause 7. Perhaps you could tell us what the difference is between deprivation and expropriation.
Honourable Sir McIntosh, you've certainly done justice, Honourable James.
Thank you, Chair. Also, thank you to Minister Davies for a very concise and compelling presentation. I had a question. Well, I wanted him to simply comment on the following, which is whether the lack of a proper legal environment for having independent power producers and even independent buyers in the electricity market, whether you see that as a serious obstacle to getting your side of the job done. You mentioned alternative forms of energy and the ability therefore for those alternative power producers and renewable energy to feed into the electricity grid and so on. The legal environment was supposed to be in place a long time ago with the Eastman Bill. And if you just would comment on that for me, please.
Thank you, Honourable James. Honourable Fadebe.
Chairperson, I take a cue from Honourable James that this is not only a compelling presentation, it's a good presentation, it's a good story to tell.
You've been too modest. It's a good story to tell.
Accepted, Honourable James. Chairperson, I think this presentation is good and then it's really comprehensive. It shows the work which was done over the period of 5 years. And then, as you said, that when the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation declared the trade industry as one of the best run departments, it was not wrong. You can see from the outcomes of this presentation and the one we had last week. Chair, but what I want to deal with is the challenges which are coming out on the issue of beneficiation and the issue of steel industry in particular. With the challenges of the steel prices, what is the plan going forward, Chair? Because really, I think that when we visited ArcelorMittal and then when we also visited the auto industry in the Eastern Cape, it was very clear that the ArcelorMittal is not providing all the steel sheets which are needed for the cars within the country. So, but at the same time, the price of steel is so high in such a way that it is like we're importing steel wherever we're having all the resources here. With that joint testing which was there between the minerals, economic development, where are they stuck now? Because we thought that during that time, it will come with a better resolution to the problem. And number two, Chairperson, the issue of the opportunities. We know that, as Honourable McIntosh has spoken about, the issue of BMW scaling down its operation in some of the plants here. But at the same time, with the issue of the auto industry going down in Australia, what opportunity or what the department do to ensure that we can capture that market, which is going to be eliminated from the side of the Australians. And then the last one, Chair, but not the least, with this, you know, around 2010 and 2011, there were huge fires in Russia where the wheat product was wiped off in such a way that they withdrew some of their wheat into the international market. Automatically, the price of wheat went up all over the world. So with this issue of the undemocratic tendencies of the West, with what is happening now there in Europe, you know, in particular in Ukraine, what impact is it going to have to us here in South Africa? Because Russia is part of BRICS, and then being part of BRICS, I think that we are in a lot of agreements with them in moving forward. Is it, what impact is going to be, if there are any problems, they escalate?
Honourable
Kadebe,
Honourable Favasa.
Chair, just one question. At the start of the industrial policy execution plan, there was great emphasis on creating labor-intensive jobs, and we while still are creating jobs, we seem to be failing though to create jobs that would absorb the semi-skilled and unskilled workers. Of course, one must acknowledge that the EPWP program is also, you know, kind of mopping up at that level. But at the level of creating sustainable unskilled jobs, we seem to be failing. I want to understand, Minister, what are our challenges in that regard? I raise this, but also in the context of the fact that indeed we are creating jobs that require skills. The example thereof is, there was a report just recently that about 365,000 expatriates returned back to the country last year up to about January this year, and all of them have found jobs. Meaning we indeed are succeeding to create skilled jobs, and therefore that emphasizes the point that we keep on making, that we must escalate skills, education and skills development. So we are succeeding in that regard, but we seem to have weaknesses at the other end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, the Honourable Kwabasa. Honourable Salah.
Thanks very much, Chair President. Clearly, one can look at this particular presentation from an angle of a tree. The name of this tree that we are working on in South Africa is IPA. And this tree has got a number of very important branches. It has grown, it has now branches, and those branches include mining, manufacturing, agro-processing, beneficiation, SMMEs and co-ops. And we are beginning to see a growth in this branch of incubation. And there's also infrastructure built that we are busy working on. All of these are forming up this tree called IPA. We're doing everything to nourish this tree through the creation of skills, through ways, incentives, so as to be able to give people jobs. And all of these are intended to lead towards a prosperous South Africa. That's where we're going. The key challenge here, Honourable Minister, is that this tree needs water. And that water is energy. Energy, that's the water to this tree. For it to grow and grow and grow bigger and bigger. And we are in a serious challenge of energy prices going higher at the moment. How do we think of ways through which we can be able to mitigate against this water getting dry and therefore killing our tree, our beloved tree?
Thank you very much, Honourable Salah. The last point, question or comment, Honourable Waili.
Thanks very much, Comrade Chairperson. And also let me join the team in terms of applauding the minister and the rest of the team for the good report. One of the questions that I want to pose is relates to the issue of the energy. I think it has been dealt with, especially in the current atmosphere, because we may have good intention in terms of investment, industrialization, but the recent power outages, whatever, to what an extent are those damaging the reputation and the industry of the country, especially from the foreign direct investment point of view? I think the recent ones. The second aspect relates to skills. In the industry, if you talk industrialization, you find that number of artisans, there's what is called an aging artisan grouping that exists in a number of industries. Is there any strategy in terms of ensuring that we able to move very quick before they exit the industries in terms of building a solid foundation in terms of artisans across the length and breadth of number of sectors? I think, Honorable Minister, you have identified the agriculture as one of the niche. I think number of people, even in BRICS Cooperative Summit, they have exposed the huge potential for the country. Even at the time I was serving in the Presidential Infrastructure Commission, if you look to 18 strategic projects, one of them were exposed to the reality that there's a food shortage in the country, whether you talk soya beans. But is there any collaboration between department and other sister department, be it rural development, so that we can move in a very focused and a coherent way in terms of identifying and also grappling with that particular niche at our disposal? Because I firmly believe that it can make a huge impact in so far as job creation in the rural areas, including the value chain. The last one is during the era of when globalization was so intense, there were a number of challenges where it was alert that South African companies are not competitive. As a result, number of companies, even international, were moving from what is called high to low production areas, like the Eastern Bloc. And as a result, in the country, there were some companies who were moving to Botswana because of the so-called cheap labor. But to what an extent is that threat confronting us as a country? But furthermore, is there any future for foundries in this particular country? Because there are a number of companies around PE, the foundries. So they are of the view that very soon we're going to kiss goodbye to the foundry. I don't know whether those threats are a reality or not. Maybe the last one is the maritime industry. What opportunities do we have as a country around the maritime industry? Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Waili. Minister, I just have one or two questions. I was very impressed by the internship one that you were working on with, it would seem, education, higher education, but it was not clear how long the internships were, the period at DTI itself. The other aspect was in looking at the opportunities here and identifying them, I think certainly while much has been done during this tenure of DTI, your own here in, as the leadership minister, you've done a lot in terms of procurement through localization and so, you know, or localization through procurement, and we accept that, but I think that there we still need to go a long way. The other issue is the Mineral Resources Development Act, which again you, you know, during your time here in office in this tenure, you have, and the department, focused in that area. And I think it is, we'll certainly have to, in our own legacy document, indicate that there we do need to deepen our strategies in that as you started them and established them and went a long way with respect to the scrap metal issue. But one of the things, the SEZ, IEZ, going into SEZ, I remember 2 years ago we held a colloquium on IPAP and some of the issues that came up in terms of admin costs and so on were port charges. And we were under the impression that quite a lot had been done positively there with respect to value-added goods, the manufacturing sector. Although one has heard, even in the media and now here, in your own report, Minister, that you know one of the challenges are continuing high port charges and freight, etc. And certainly a clarification would be appreciated in that direction. But over to you, Ministers. I think the members have really, you know, considered your report. Thank you, Minister.
Okay, well, thanks, Chair. Maybe some of the team will also come in after I've made my comments. I just want to start off with the Honourable Khadebe's last point. We don't have a good story to tell. We have a good story to tell. So let me start off with the Honourable McIntosh's points. First of all, factually, on BMW, we didn't lose an investment. The BMW company told us that there was a possibility of a new investment, and that as a result of the strike, that new investment wouldn't happen. I don't think it was a foregone conclusion that that investment would have happened if there hadn't been a strike. It was a competition between a number of other possibilities, but that was the actual impact. There was quite a lot of inaccurate reportage around the time. And for example, it was suggested that the decision by Nissan to invest in Nigeria indicated that everyone was moving from here to Nigeria. Well, not so. We've actually been working with Nigeria because Nigeria is starting a motor industry. They will be using semi-knockdown kits, and we are looking at the possibility we support them in developing their motor industry, and then the semi-knockdown kit inputs would come from us. So we are happy to see a motor industry emerge in Nigeria. It's not that it's not a zero-sum game as far as we are concerned. But the more general point, I think you saw where we put labor relations volatility. It wasn't the first item, wasn't the main item, wasn't the main challenge, but it's one challenge among several others that we highlighted. And I think it's not so much that we have a regime where there are rights of workers and rights to collective bargaining. That's an absolute must in South Africa. I think anybody thinks that we can just move to a situation where employers will set wages and conditions unilaterally and you're going to get labor peace and lower costs, I think is living in a fool's paradise. You're going to have a huge uproar. And some of the challenges we face in labor relations are because the coherence is under threat from breakaways and things like that. I think what we've got to do is build the coherence of the industrial relations system. And it was interesting in the motor industry that NUMSA, which is a union which is having its differences with the rest of COSATU, as I'm sure you all know, NUMSA signed on to the automotive productivity program which we launched at the Johannesburg International Motor Show. So I think that we can draw in
Labour as partners, and we need to draw in Labour as partners. I think that's the critical point I would make there. On the question of platinum, the issue is that the Motor Industry Development Programme, the incentives in the MIDP were based on exports. The APDP, they're based on value addition. And what you have in platinum or catalytic converters is a difference in the measuring of the benefit, because the value addition is quite low because the platinum is quite a high part of the final price. When you export it, you get a much higher return than if you measured on value addition. We made an adjustment, but a limited adjustment, in the APDP to try to cater for that. But there's also an early review of the APDP, which is going to look at those kind of issues. And I think that we really do need to support value addition in this country. And I think that is the basis and the design of the APDP. But we will look and see what it does mean. We are also trying to get higher levels of value addition in exhaust systems, because typically what we've seen is the thing comes in, it's got a ceramic part, and then the ceramic part is coated with platinum. And that was what we were having in South Africa. We also want the ceramics to be manufactured here. So I think we're looking at all of those kind of issues, and there is an early review of the APDP, so we can look at a number of those matters. If I didn't mention skills, it's not because we don't think skills is important. It was an oversight, but skills is fundamental. I mean, I think that every single program that we have, I did mention it briefly, because the 12i tax incentive does include an additional allowance if you're involved in skills development. Skills development is absolutely fundamental. I mean, I think that, just to give my take on where we are going, we were an economy where, I said on a few occasions, Verwoerd was a tyrant and an oppressor when he said that, why should I spend money on the education of black children when they're only going to be hewers of wood and drawers of water. But I said he wasn't a fool, because at that time, the people that ran this economy, what they wanted was large quantities of cheap, unskilled labor to do pick and shovel work in the gold mining industry. That was what they wanted. But what's happened is, since the 1970s, that gold mining industry has passed its peak, and wherever jobs are created in the gold mining industry, now they are higher skills. And this is also going along with global trends. I mentioned this thing, this new machine age. There is a serious ongoing substitution of routine labor by all kinds of ICT-related innovation that's taking place. That we must expect to continue. But conceptual labor, ICT can't match. What does this mean? It means that, as I was saying earlier on, if we have job creation in this economy, not on the scale that we need it, the jobs that are being created are for people with high levels of skill. That's what it is. We've got to address the unemployment question by addressing skills upgrading, and then all the different parts through the chain, basic education, higher education, and then even what I was saying earlier on, internship opportunities and so on. Skills development is absolutely fundamental. I actually went to launch the Sespikili quantum project in Toyota a few years ago. And we were importing all the minibus taxis. Now we were starting to assemble them again. We introduced an incentive. They can assemble them for a while, then they've got to come into completely knocked down kit manufacturing later on. But I went around and they showed us all the different workstations. And all of them were being led by young people, under 30, black people. Were all the ones who were the heads of it. But all of them had an engineering qualification. That's what it is, you see, that's a skill set. And if we don't produce those skills, then what we're going to have is we're going to have a shortage of those skills. And as our economy picks up, that's going to be the biggest constraint. So I think that I've no doubt, no question in my mind that skills development is quite fundamental. And it is built into a number of our programs. The NEBUS is what I mentioned. It's the National Informal Business Upliftment Strategy, which we're going to launch on Imports in Johns on Friday. That's what it is.
and I mentioned it, we focus, we've been pulling things out of small business which we think are high impact. We've got one which is supporting incubation for reasons I mentioned. The other one now is now informal business. How do we support the upliftment of small of informal business? One of the things we're going to do is provide incentive for infrastructure in the Nebus, which we're going to launch in Port St. John's. The red tape reduction thing our definition of red tape is unnecessary regulation, not deregulation, not the same thing, but unnecessary regulation, unnecessary duplication, unnecessary information, an attitude at stake where you don't really care whether you ask the people to come back with their mother's birth certificate because you couldn't care because you're a bureaucrat, that kind of stuff. And we have a pilot project, we're working with COPTA, we're rolling it out in municipalities because I think we think that those are some of the biggest issues there. But we've done a few things ourselves, and some of them involve partnerships. For example, with one of the banks, perhaps I shouldn't mention you because we're trying to roll it out with all the others, but with one of the banks, you can now walk in and open your business bank account, and you can use their ICT to link into the company's Intellectual Property Commission office, and for 150 Rand you can register your company. That's what you can do now. That's a considerable reduction in red tape, and that's provided for in the Companies Act because you can run a small business on a number under the new Companies Act rather than having to wait for your name registration. You can do your name registration later, you can start running your business on the basis of your number. So that's one of the things we've done. And then I think this thing in the, you know, we had private red tape, where somebody wanted to contract a black supplier, and you're 100% owned black company. They said, no, you must go out and get a verification agency to tell us that you are like that. Because all they wanted was, they didn't care about the company really, they just wanted the points. And it was costing 40,000 Rand, I'm told, 40,000 Rand to do this. We say, now you must accept an affidavit. If you think the guys are lying, you must take it to the commission that's established under the BE Bill. And you must just accept an affidavit. You can't insist that they pay 40,000 Rand. We've cut that red tape. But the red tape reduction is about a whole lot of municipal regulation that we think is in place. It's not only at municipal level, by the way, it's also at national and also at provincial level, but that's what it's about. And then I don't know where deprivation, I mean, what we're basically saying is that if there's expropriation under the, I mean, that's what all of these investment treaties say, if there's expropriation, there's compensation. And so we've provided for the compensation in the draft bill, so I don't think we've used the word deprivation. I think it was actually expropriation. I'm not sure, but you could check that maybe if you like. On the Honourable James's comments, look, I think the issue is that at the moment, renewable energy and IPP is more expensive than Eskom power. That's the truth. So there's a role for it, but it's not a magic bullet that's going to solve everything. I mean, I have a relative who's involved in the environmental business in an NGO, they're often talking about it, and I said, well, look what happened when the coal got wet. Imagine if we just dispensed with the coal, what would happen to the power situation? But we do need base load coal-driven power for some time, while we complement it with other forms of energy. I don't know. I mean, it's not in our portfolio. Where we have come in is when there has been, because we did mention that, where there has been, obviously there's a trade-off between the investments by whoever in energy are going to be recouped in the form of the electricity price. That's what's going to happen, unless we're going to subsidize it, which you can't do. So it's going to be recouped. And then there's a whole pricing question that comes up. And obviously, Eskom would like to have the best possible balance sheet and the quickest possible recovery, and that means the price increase that they would want would tend to be a little bit higher than everybody else wants. And we have come in and said, well, we must be sensitive to industrial customers. I mean, there's a sensitivity already built in about low-income consumers, which is correct, but there must also be a sensitivity about industrial customers. That's where we've come in, and I think that we have managed in the last couple of price determinations, we've had an influence on this process as well. On the question of the steel price, I think one of the things that we're trying to do is bring more competition into the production of steel in South Africa. So, in fact, the scrap metal thing, and it gets to the question about the smelters, because there are smelter technologies that are using scrap metal and producing steel products. What the Honourable Khadebe said is exactly what I've noticed too. Is you go around and somebody tells you that this steel used to be available from ArcelorMittal, it no longer is. It's now imported. That is a serious problem, and the steel price remains high. One of the lines of work is to support alternative steel makers and more competition. Some of it will come from scrap metal. People who have now got an advantage and are beginning to come on. And some of them are using technology like this Agni one I went to. It's called convector technology. So it's different from arc furnace. You use less energy, basically. And it's smaller scale operations. It's an Indian investor using a technology they use in India. I think we could, there are those. There are also projects that have been in the pipeline to use the iron ore, which is a byproduct of other mining, it's so-called high-felt steel, where we have more iron ore, in fact, available than we do have in Sishen, which is the best higher quality stuff. But now we're also in a position now where, with a court ruling on the ICT case, as I understand it, it has said that the Minister of Mineral Resources can set the terms and conditions for that proportion of the output. So while it remains the property of the Sishen Iron Ore Company, that's what the court ruled, the minister can set the terms and conditions. We're having discussions on that. Then on the motor industry and Australia and all of that, I think the Australian example is the answer to everybody who says, the automotive program is expensive, we should move away from it or phase it down. And that's the answer. That's what happens if you do that. You lose your motor industry. Because anybody who thinks that the motor industry globally operates according to textbook free market principles probably believes the global agriculture industry does as well. It's not so. The ability to provide a support package is fundamental. And all these multinationals that are invested here are in competition with their counterparts in other jurisdictions. But the one thing that happened is that I think that this was the one example where the MIDP succeeded in integrating South Africa in a beneficial way into global value chains. Because we used to have production for the local market, short runs, high cost, high tariffs. Tariffs have gone down, but the tariffs are still necessary. And that's why we've frozen it. We're not dropping it. We're going to keep it at 25%. But we are now in global value chains. So we produce, as you know, we produce the C-class Mercedes across the world, the ones that are driven in Japan because they drive on the same side of the road as us. The ones in Australia, because I think they drive on the same side as us, I come from South Africa. I say with the BMW 3 Series. So I think that's what it'll be. It won't be that suddenly there's an Australian market and all models are available and we can suddenly gear up for the Australian market. But we're in the global value chain, so I think that's where we're at. And then on the that there was an expectation that we were going to create labour-intensive jobs, the EPWP, and all of that, Honourable Kobasa. I think that the everything that we do is measured in terms of job creation. But I think that when we come to manufacturing, it's not that we're saying all the jobs are going to be in manufacturing itself, but we also have to look at the job multipliers that come from manufacturing and from an industrializing economy. That's what we need to look at. And in fact, around the world, and I think this is part of what I was getting to earlier on about the technology changes that are taking place. You see that increases in output in manufacturing are not matched by increases in employment in the sector. But we try to go for the more labor-intensive options. So, for example, we insist on localization in the motor industry. Why?
as if you want a higher level of automotive investment scheme, because there are many more jobs created with much less investment in component manufacturing than there are in the OEMs. If you don't have an OEM, you don't have the components, but the jobs are in components. I think I've already dealt with the question of the energy. The energy is fundamental. I mean, if we have cheaper energy, we have to have affordable energy, we have to have no serious spikes in energy, but that's the lesson of the United States. The United States is much more energy self-sufficient and also got lower cost energy. That's what's driving reindustrialization. Well, apart from the fact that at one stage the United States, along with other countries, thought that we were living in a post-industrial world and we could let manufacturing go, which they did, and now they're all trying to reindustrialize. But their advantage is cheap energy. And power outages on FDI, well, yeah, it is a factor. It is a factor. I mean, I don't think that we've seen anybody. We haven't seen anybody for any reason, either the power outages or the strikes, who's come to us and told us, and I keep asking, well, we were going to invest in South Africa, now we're not. We're not. We haven't got that. But it is a concern, man. Even in Japan, I went to Japan, we were walking around in summer and they were telling us not to wear jackets and ties because they had something called cool biz. And that was because they didn't have any energy in Japan to run the air conditioners in the offices because of Fukushima. Even then, and they were having this cool biz and everything else, energy saving, power cuts. But even there, they were raising it as a matter in South Africa. So it is a factor. We do have to ensure energy security. That's why we are making the big investments in Medupi and Kosi. Now, by the way, I don't agree that the problems, the biggest problems in Medupi have been the strike. They've also been the contractors' non-fulfillment of their conditions. That's one of the big issues there. On agriculture, yes, agro-processing depends very much on a strong relationship with agriculture. One of the things that has happened is that there has been a decision taken that agriculture will start something called the Agriculture Policy Action Plan, APAP, building on the architecture and style of IPAP. So DAF is developing this. I think it will come into effect in the next administration. So I think that's an indication there. And we have to fight, and we do work with agriculture quite a lot, because that is very, very fundamental. Then are South African companies going to neighboring countries, Botswana? I think the ability of industrial companies to just move to somewhere because the labor is cheaper. It doesn't really happen like that. There's many other things that have to be in place. But we do see that, we are encouraging it actually within the framework of SACA. We do need to build regional value chains that does include our neighbors in SACA. We do need to try to find ways in which we can develop industries in their countries, draw them into an understanding in the framework of SACA that industrialization is not just about one of us, it's about all of us. I think there have been the odd case here and there of somebody putting their toe into one of those countries because of cheap labor, but I don't think it really works unless other conditions are in place. So, for example, I mean, Lesotho's got a clothing industry, but it's not just based because the wages are different. It's based on the fact that they have access to the United States for third country fabric under a goer, which we don't have. The foundries I mentioned, the maritime industry, well, we have in IPAP, we have a boat building section, which also includes moving into the direction of ship repair, and eventually things like tugboats, I think, are being looked at, those kind of boats. The internships, well, there were 1,200 internships that we were providing for. I'm not quite sure the period is. I don't think the period is fixed. Depends on the sector concerned. And then on the port charges. Yes, I think we achieved a very significant breakthrough in the port charges. And I think the document is telling us that it's less of a problem than it used to be, but we still need to ensure, and that's what a lot of the investments and the infrastructure development is about, we still need to ensure that our port charges are more supportive of manufactured or value-added exports and prioritize those. I think that was it. I don't know if the DG wants to add anything or anybody else.
No, you certainly did. That was a comprehensive coverage, Minister. And it's this kind of comprehensive coverage and cooperation that we have appreciated over 5 years. You know, a transparency in your approach, which I know the Honourable James is not here as I talk, and neither is Honourable McIntosh, but both of them have expressed this time and time again, that we are very fortunate in having, the department that we have in front of us, and yourself as Minister.
Let me say this will be my last word to the Portfolio Committee and this administration, at least, and who knows what happens after that. I may be in retirement. But just... sure. what I was simply going to say is that I've appreciated the way that you have created space for us to engage with the committee, and we've always welcomed an interaction with Parliament, because I think that we felt that Parliament not only does oversight, but Parliament is also an important forum for discussing a lot of the issues. I mean, I think that we still have some way to go in South Africa to recognize the significance of industrialization. And I'll give an example. When I don't take these things that seriously, but when I look at the end of the year and I have these report cards, and I see the one which is negatives about me is this, how bang on about industrialization. And to the expense of other sectors. Well, there's a reason for that. There's a logic. The logic in development, and I think that we're not yet in that space in South Africa where we all understand that. They don't have that kind of angst in other successful emerging economies, so they all know why they need to industrialize. But the input of the committee and the possibility of the committee engaging on that, I think, has been extremely valuable as well. So thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Minister. And certainly to the DG, all the DDGs, chief directors, commissioners, we thank all of you. We're not finished with the morning or the afternoon, family. But I just thought one would take this opportunity and just indicate yes, we do have a dinner this evening, and I'm hoping that the relevant people all receive their invitations, and we'll be able to express our appreciation more this evening. But thank you very much to the department and yourself, Minister. Now, members, just before we entertain the lottery, although I know many of you play it, what we want to do is just to pass these minutes. So I know that, you know, certain nephew Thunder, as we're doing a little bit of kitchen stuff for 5 minutes, will come up to the front here. Right, members, if you pick up your minutes, and we go to the 18th of February, which is fresh in your memories. And I'm looking at page 1, 18th of February. Page 2, in earnest conversation with our National Parliamentary Legal Advisor that day. And page 3, we have someone to propose adoption. Thanks, Honourable Khadebe, seconded by Kwabasa. The 20th of February, a Thursday, you will recall that evening there in V119, stole what you came. And there again, the consideration of the National Credit Amendment Bill. The formal process began, and page 3. We have somebody to propose adoption of those minutes. Thank you, Honourable Waili, seconded by Honourable Shopbase Tore. Right. Friday, the 21st of February. A wonderful day that was, as we got through the bill, page 1, page 2. You can see your names here, etched for eternity on Hansard. 3, 4, 5, 6. If it's not there, you ought to say something. It's a pity Honourable McIntosh isn't here, as he sees his final objection to something recorded here on page 7. Because, as you know, he's retiring from Parliament. So, can I have someone to propose adoption to those minutes? Thank you, Honourable Salah, seconded by the Honourable Babasa. Wednesday, the 26th of February. Everyone present again. Page 1. Page 2. This is the one where I think Honourable Kwabasa was really showing, you know, going through his paces as chairperson, running that meeting, as I recall. The World Trade Organization, am I correct, Honourable Kwabasa? Yes. And then page 3. You did some very serious stuff there, the final consideration of the special economic zones that came back from the NCOP, with a couple of minor amendments which we agreed to on page 4 and on page 5. And there we are. So can we have someone to propose adoption of those minutes, please? Thank you, Honourable Khadebe, seconded by Honourable Waili. I notice it's always wise, Honourable Kwabasa, when you've chaired not to second your own minutes. they can see the later objection. Right. I know, I'm lucky when one is sitting up here, you know, you don't second anything. Right. The 5th of March, very recently that is, the third quarterly report, the briefing on the draft national policy on intellectual property, the policy, such an important piece. Really, members, when you leave for constituency, do something about it in your constituency. Page 1, page 2. It's attached. It's so small and so important. I think it must have been done in single spacing. Page 3. And this really is serious. And then we had the whole issue on the briefing by ETI on its third quarter report and the deliberations of the committee thereof. And page 4, we then had that final thing on, as I said, the national policy on intellectual property. I'm really trying to make a big thing because it is important. It is. And if this is the last thing you take out of this committee, take it into the constituency. Can we have someone to propose adoption of the 5th of March? Honourable Salah, seconded by Honourable Kwabasa. just checking. No, thank you very much.
It's just 5:00.
10:10. Give me 30 seconds and then I'll come back. Yes. Professor Nebutunda, I'm glad I, as it were, saw you very briefly with Mancos this morning, because one was really trying to apologize in a lot of ways for giving you a graveyard shift and almost trying to squeeze you out of existence, and that was not the intention. So the thing is, what we want, you know, this particular, the NLB, was one of the first things we dealt with straight after gambling. I think EDG and Thule will remember that, while I was still learning how to chair, and she was still teaching us all a few things. So there we are, and then hot on our heels came the National Lotteries Board, and the fact that we needed a new board. Do you remember? Well, of course you wouldn't remember that because you weren't then chairing that board, yes. But the point is, members, we go back a long way. We gave birth to this NLB, this board. And you know, when you give birth to a baby, it's very important to treasure that. It's something you want to nurture and guide. So it is with regret that one recognizes the time constraints, Honourable, for Debbie Harwood, and I hope you'll understand that, all right? So just give us briefly, it's basically a recognition of the kind of budget issues, any, you know, sort of the challenges or where you wish to go in the next 5 years. We leave that to you, Professor.
Thank you, Jefferson. You forgive me on the voice. My voice is not yet back. No, I was hit by the stroke last year. So with me, I'm having the CEO of the company, Shabat Mampane, advocate Colin, who is a member of the board. Also, Robert Toon is also a member of the board. Jeffrey Dupree is the head of the grant funding. Anashi Maharaj, she's here on behalf of finance because she's operating there. Sanele Gamini, office of the CEO. Well, the strategy as crafted is very much well known, that we are here to improve the impact of the National Lottery Distribution Trust Fund, also to add our voice on reviewing regulatory practice. We also sustain organizational capability. That's why we are existing until this time. We also ensure that there is a stability in terms of grant funding and also assisting organizations that fall within ourselves. Well, the progress to date, Honorable Chairperson, is that the NLD has made strides ever since you gave us the go-ahead. This board has achieved so many issues. Amongst the issues that the board has achieved is appointment of the new CEO, improved risk management, which one believes that the organization was just running without, you know, attending to risk issues and the like. Roll out of fraud awareness campaigns. We are on public, making sure that the public must know. Improved performance and financial reporting. Enhanced controls, internal controls. These controls, I must confess, Honorable Jefferson, that to the public, it may sound like we are increasing turnaround times. We realize that we are dealing with public funds. If we just distribute these funds to people that we don't know, to organizations that we are not clear whether they are going to implement the project, you are all aware that last year we got a surprise seeing something in the newspaper saying that we have been defrauded $4 million by a person from outside South Africa. So that made us to tighten our internal controls. The board has approved the implementation of verification process, which talks to verification of all grant applications. We have realized that there are so many scams outside. Some of them are schools, some of them are clubs, some of them are individuals who don't have projects on the ground. So what they do, they go to accountants who are not registered or who have been blacklisted, and they cook the finance. They bring them to us, and then they they get the funding. And remember, when they bring them, they don't bring them to us who are the trustees. They are bringing to the distributing agencies, who sometimes, because of the paper trail, they just say, this is correct. So the registration process entails the following. We have appointed internal auditors who are in the building, who are doing the auditing of all grants. Unfortunately, when you try to implement good measures, the majority of poor people suffer. The majority of poor people suffer because of people who have studied the organization and mastered all the trades. I think it is in this house that I even reported that one man tried to have IDs, I think 25 IDs, and he applied projects. And when the only projects were approved, there was only one person who was administering these projects. So the reason why we appointed the internal auditors is to audit applications, especially financial statements, according to the current Act. Our verification officers visit projects to ascertain their existence. Honorable Chairperson, the stories that we are getting, you know their death is very sad. You find people not knowing that they've applied. Somebody applied on their behalf. Somebody applies from Joburg, knowing that because Northern Cape is suffering, he does not need 5%, he applies from Joburg, as if the project will be done in Kimberley, and there's no project. Some of them are found in the aeroplanes, some of them are found in the buses, to say, don't you want to be in partner with me? So these are the stories that are emerging recently. The grant funding process has been aligned such that every project gets subjected to a verification process, pre and post, so that we get clear whether there is a project. We have appointed 5 companies who, I'm sorry to say this, we received a letter, myself and the CEO, from a community member complaining that we are doing this verification which is not planned, because Susan Saluwa Gobodo were moving around the country to check some of these projects, and sometimes they don't even get the offices, the addresses are wrong, the bank accounts are wrong. In Kimberley, one individual who is a business lady decided to make herself a contact person of a radio station, so that when NLB approves the money, they must phone her, and the money will go to her. Very young. And if I tell you, there's a project that I think it was granted close to 10 million. So we don't have any other option but to guard the fund jealously, because the facts outside have studied our modus operandi, and therefore we have blocked it. And it will take time sometimes to improve on this. We have appointed those companies. They are doing the work on the ground. We have set up the contract center, which is reporting everything, assigning legal secretaries to sit in the adjudication panels. Because we are not there, the legal company secretaries sit in there and advise members who are adjudicating. The verification process aligns to the Public Finance Management Act. We don't pay before we are clear. Adjudication discussions are recorded, and this process, distributing agencies are aware. Organizations whose applications are not compliant are communicated with, and the interviews are scheduled. In other words, if your application is not compliant, we don't just throw it away. We call you, we advise you, this is what you should do. Once every quarter, Zordon to the chair the committee on board DA. In other words, where the chairpersons of distributing agencies come and get the report. The number of projects that were verified during this financial year are 26, and of the verified projects, 21 have been found to have major irregularities, 5 with no irregularities. Of these projects, 4 projects have been referred to law enforcement agencies. There was a project that was 75 million, which we rescued it, and it was referred to law enforcement agencies. To date, whistleblowing and fraud hotline reporting, you can see this, the statistics there. If it's not there, let me read it to you. The cases, the status of the cases, there were 244 that were reported, 76 finalized, 114 in progress, 54 pending investigation. Outcome of final cases, 76 in total, major irregularities 60, minor irregularities 11, clear 5, only 5. So in terms of internal control, it is very hard now to defraud the NLB. We can proudly say that it is difficult, because we are now talking to SARS, we are now talking to CIPIC, so that all the directors that are found in the NPOs, we have to check them in the SARS, whether they are paying tax, whether they are not paying tax. That's why I'm saying it's a sad story, because even honest people are now subjected to very, very strict conditions. Because what we have learned is that some people register a company today and apply, they go and remove all the directors in the form. It now becomes a company of a human being. So we have tried to stop all these things. So the new act, I think, is being implemented with us being prepared for the new things. Jeffrey will just quickly give you the grant funding report and finance. That will be the end of the story.
Thank you, Jefferson. Members of the committee, just then briefly on, I think as members would recall, currently the applications are coming through a call for application except for miscellaneous, and this is just the statistics around the last calls which were happening in 2012 and 2013 on the various dates that you would see under the closing date. I think the slide up there is a little bit in front. That's right. So that's just the statistics on the slide. But let me jump to this one. For the grant allocation status as of 31st of December 2013, the budgets, if you can see the individual budgets per sector, because remember in terms of the regulations, the budget is split according to their percentages, 45% for charities, 22% sport, 28% arts and culture, and 5%. So the budgets reflect there in terms of the available budget. The total was two billion, just over 2 billion. Of that, as at the end of the third quarter, 1.6 billion has already been allocated. The what is referred to as amounts, kind of a drawn as kind of reversals, and that can be for various reasons. For example, if I've got a multi-tranche project payment, and after the first tranche, there's a report, and I said I've made some savings on projects XYZ. Usually organizations will require to say, can I use it for something else? But if there's no justifiable reason, for example, the agency might decide that money must be returned if it's not in line with the original project, then that's what that column there is just talking to. And so the available budget then overall, individually, as per that list, then was 380 million. The number of organizations that has been allocated funded was just over 3,000. And the last column is just giving an average, and that is purely based on if you take the amount of allocations in total and you divide it by the number of organizations, you get the average. But as we know, in the practical world, it doesn't mean that everybody is getting 4 million for us. One might get 1 million, the other must get 10 million, and so forth. But just on average, that is the kind of the figures that you would get. Next slide, please. That is just a breakdown of the provincial split. I think the chairperson of the board had referred to the Northern Cape when he was talking about some of the mechanisms and stories that's been used to try and defraud the organization. In terms of the regulations, we're supposed to achieve 5% minimum per province. Historically, we've been struggling with Mpumalanga, Northwest Free State, and Northern Cape amongst those provinces. And part of the reason is, relatively speaking, if we compare with KZN, Gauteng, Western Cape, you would have, number one, fewer organizations, registered NGOs in those areas, and there's other various reasons for that. We are, as per the third quarter report, we are short with Northern Cape. We're still trying everything in our power to see whether we can address that. But there is a number of strategies and mechanisms that we've been discussing with the distributing agencies to try and deal with this thing on a more sustainable basis to be able to achieve those targets, including, for example, approach of targeted calls where you're very much specific to address those deficits. That is just a further breakdown of that same, of the previous slide, but now members can just see on that slide, now we're giving the percentages as per the individual sectors. So the reds are basically showing all those provinces for that particular sectors where the 5% hasn't been achieved. Just a comment on miscellaneous. It looks a little bit skewed because the miscellaneous one is the one that comes, you know, and it's, I think part of the analysis is that it has to do with knowledge, also to have to do a little bit with proximity. And that's why one of the things that the board have decided moving forward is also to introduce some calls for that particular sector. But I think in terms of the new act, actually, they changed a little bit to more special projects kind of category, which will have a much more proactive approach to it. And I think it will deal with that kind of skewed distribution that members are seeing there. Next. Sorry?
I'm just wondering now, you said thanks and then everyone sat. Right. I think it's a change.
Thank you. This is the slide. Thank you, Chair. The slide that Mr. Dupree had not presented. I thought it was important for him just to indicate what happened since the last calls until where we are now.
Thank you, CEO Chairperson. That is just a slide giving, as I said, indicated arts and culture. The closing date was on the 18th of April, 2013. The total number of applications received, applications completed, remaining 2,300. The completion rate was 17% at that particular stage, 31st of December. Charities, closing date was in December 12, 2012. Additionally, and always receiving quite a high level number of applications, remaining with 3,700, a completion rate of 52% as per the end of December. And then sports was, closing date was 2nd of November 2012, 4,371, completed 3,571 with 82% completion rate. The last point there is just that if we take the number of applications and which exceeded 14,000 in total, and you take the just purely on what people apply for, Madam Chair, you will find that if you look at a 2 billion rand budget, most probably that request, if you have to give everybody that you ask of, is 20 times the available funds. And that is one of the challenges, and I think one of the things that we started to discuss moving forward, that we will have to deal with very strategically, given that reality, that every time the ask for the money is much more than it's available. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I am just quickly going to take the committee through our third quarter report as it was requested. The slide just indicates our equity status in the organization. At the executive level, we have a 40-60 split, with 60% being female and 40% male at management level. 37% is females and 53% of the management team is, sorry, it's 47, yes, I should have corrected that yesterday, I'm sorry about that. And that 53% is males, and for staff, we have a total number of 133 staff members, 58% of that number is female and 42% is male. We do have contract workers as well, and the total number is 12, 10 of which is female, and they constitute 84%, and two of them are male, and it's 16%. We've been actually trying very hard to create an opportunity for interns and learners, and to that end, we have 26 of them who are in the organization, and they are female. 46% are female, and that is 12, and 14 are male, and it's 54. So from a gender perspective, we think we are balanced. The only area where we seem to be lacking a bit is with the employment of a white male. We're busy with the process of populating another level of the organizational structure, and that is what we'll definitely prioritize. This is just an indication of the training programs attended by staff. In the interest of time, let me just go to the training budget and to say at end of December, the total year-to-date budget was 2 million, and out of that, 1.3 million had been spent on training. Another area which for us shows a lot of improvement, Chairperson and committee members, it's the media coverage statistics, but we're just trying to give an indication that in that quarter, there's been a lot of improvement. The majority of media coverage would have been positive about the National Lotteries Board. There were instances, of course, where there were reports as to what the Chairperson said when the issue around Basari Empowerment Trust and LIFAS was in the newspaper. We nearly suffered some negative publicity, but we worked hard to maintain that. And the table in front of you is just to give an indication of if we had to pay money to get publicity at the NLB, how much money would have spent. And we are saying if we were to do that in that quarter, we would have spent close to 3 million rands, but this was something we didn't pay for. We also have a very active contact center which is serving as an interface between us and our beneficiaries. That's an indication of the number of calls, an area where we're improving, because we analyze this information to try and find out
whether some of the information that we're getting from the call center is information that we can use when we go to our stakeholder engagements and try to assist our people. This is an indication of those people who just walk into the organization and the type of assistance that they require. Most of them come to the NLB to inquire about funding requirements. Others is follow-up on applications. Others are submitting reports, and others, of course, come to sign grant agreements. What we didn't say, or what the chairperson didn't say, is that another way of trying to facilitate the process of paying, that is after the adjudication process, is to call people in to come and sign grant agreements at the National Lotteries Board so that we can process the payment immediately thereafter. Chairperson, I don't know whether after all what we have said, we have to take you through our performance against the business plan, except for the first part that Mr. Dupree has already alluded to, that we're working hard to look at how we can improve that 4%, and that at the end of the financial year, we're in the last quarter, and we've been trying to make strides around that. And that, for your information, we had a stakeholder engagement in that province last week, and as another way of improving our performance there, an office, an NLB office, will be established in the province with the hope that the performance of the province as far as accessing our funding will improve. We have just put together 10 top strategic groups for the committee to see that we're working on this. And the first one, according to that, would have been the license transition. As you know, the NLB is busy with that process. We are at the evaluation process. The IT infrastructure, something that the board has been trying very hard to give direction on and to get management to complete. Fraud and corruption, we've spoken a lot about that. Illegal lotteries is still a problem there. We're working with different partners to try and improve the situation. The issue of conflict of interest, I think, speaks to some of the fraud matters that we discussed earlier on. Thank you, Chair. Let me just hand over to Anashni to give you just high-level information on our finances, on the budget, where we are. And we had a slide also, Anashni, which I'm not seeing here, which indicates the performance of the operator in terms of, you know, revenue generation. Thank you, Chair.
I'm sure you've seen that slide across through to Mr. Herman's tonight, right? Yes, do proceed.
Thank you, CEO. Honourable Chairperson, members, I'm going to quickly go through the financial state of the organisation, starting with the slide up there is reflective of the NLB, the income statement. You can see revenue in the region of 133 million that's come in. The matching operating costs, because the NLB actually does draw down from the NLDTF, and a little bit of interest income as the final line. On the next slide is where the meat actually rests. You can see there's indication there in terms of revenue from the operator, obviously constituting the 34% of total sales that's coming to the NLDTF. Slightly down, on average about 3% in comparison to the same period last year, predominantly due to fewer jackpots, and obviously most compromising to revenue is the sales in totality. The in terms of revenue, in terms of the sales impact has the sales has a direct impact on the revenue received, because that's the 34% that comes into the NLDTF kitty. The operating expenses, probably the most predominant aspect there is the allocation of grants, up by on average 70% in comparison to the same period last year. So total allocations have increased by 70%. The grant to the NLB is the revenue that we draw down in terms of the operating costs, and the small portion coming in there in terms of expenses, insignificant, relating to bank charges. So yes, that's where we are in terms of the 9 months ending 31 December. And last slide. Okay, there we go. This, Honourable Chairperson, presents a picture of where we are. Total cash on hand as of 31st December in the region of 4 billion. Of that amount, close on to 3 billion already committed to grants. Available from there is the 1.3, and 154 million of that 1.3 is still committed, which leaves us with a total of 1.1 billion that's available for next year in terms of funding. Thank you.
We'd like to thank you very much, and thank the whole team, Professor, because you've given us a bird's eye view, you know, a broad overview on things that we'll be able to take the next committee forward. And I think that's what we're talking about at this particular point in time. So just to, as it were, you know, put a few squibs around the place, get everyone, you know, wide open. Yeah. So are there any questions, please? Yeah. Honourable Waili, Honourable Hadebi.
Thanks very much, Comrade Chair. And also let's thank the team for the presentation. One of the questions that I want to pose is what becomes a measuring tool in terms of the social impact of the funds that we distribute? Because there's one thing in terms of going for verification, but also in terms of the process itself, what then becomes a yardstick to measure a qualitative social impact in terms of those funds in the context of the good cause approach. The second question relates to the presentation on, I don't know what is an organogram or nature of people who are employed in the institution, but I didn't hear the aspect of the people with disabilities, because I've seen the gender, but people with disabilities, it tends to be a serious problem across all sectors, but I didn't hear it. I'd like the clarity in terms of that aspect. The last issue is an issue of, I know there's a verification, but if there are big chunks of money, let's say multi-year, is there no vetting process? I don't know. There's a verification, there's vetting. These two things are completely different. Is there no vetting process for those big funds before they are distributed? Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Waili. Honourable Hadebe.
Chairperson, we appreciate the report, but what we also appreciate more is the steps which they've taken to rectify the issues of fraud which is taking place. I think the board must be appreciated for being proactive around that. But what is also, Chair, dangerous is the issue of, we passed a bill last year, an amendment bill to this, to the National
in the bill, we emphasize the issue of protecting targets, whereby there is sensitive. So, will that only spot not create more risk in moving forward? Or what did you do to mitigate against that risk? Because if this onerous process of applying and doing all those things open up these fraudulent activities, what about the issue of proactive allocation of grants? Because what I saw is that one of the critical risks is a conflict of interest. If there's a conflict of interest, let's say within the people of the board or within the institution,
how are we going to mitigate that? That conflict of interest is not translated in creating shortage research so that shortages can be funded. And then, Chair, on the, I think that one, they might not respond in answer, but I think that for the next committee, before the implementation of the amendment, there must be some sort of a report around those risks. But apart from the fact that they almost reported exclusively about the negative projects which are here, but the committee Chair, we know that there are certain things which are good, which were done by the National Elections Commission. In the village in Limpopo last year where I went, there was one integrated project which was funded by Rural Development National Interest. It was very good. It's a model whereby you